We are gathering today a group of researchers and practitioners to shed light on the role of personal narrative in effectively advancing the cause of disability rights, whether in individual cases or in the arenas of legislation and policymaking. We hope to explore how themes of autonomy and dependency, normal and abnormal, innocence and fault, sameness and difference all play out in legal discussions about disability and in the self-understanding of people with disabilities. We hope to learn how personal experience narratives concerned with disability bear on actual legal practice, how legal arguments get translated back into individuals' accounts of being disabled, and how tensions may arise between the highly individualized personal experience of disability and the necessity of developing pragmatic legal definitions of disability under relevant statutory and case law. The only credit that I can take for this venture is being smart enough to get the people who are actually responsible for the vision for this conference into the same room to sit down together and work out a plan. The original committee, a terrific group of people, included Brenda Brueggemann, David Herman, Steve Casisto, Valerie Lee, Jim Phelan, and Amy Schumann, all from the Department of English, Chris Zacher and Rick Livingston from the Institute for Collaborative Research in Public Humanities, Scott Listener, Ohio State's ADA coordinator, and Ruth Kolker and myself from the law school. Our special collaborator from back east, to give us a little geographical diversity, among other things, is Ruth O'Brien, who's professor and executive officer of the Political Science PhD and MA program at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. We're very grateful for everyone who provided financial support for this conference, including my center, of course, the Dean of the College of Law, Nancy Rogers, the Department of English, the Institute for Collaborative Research in Public Humanities, the Office of the ADA Coordinator, and we're especially grateful for grants from the Ohio Statewide Independent Living Council and the Association on Higher Education and Disability. And if things today proceed with any semblance of efficiency, it's really because of the particularly hard work of my Associate Director, Saul Berman, who oversees most of the implementation details of our plans, and three great staff people, Jenny Purcell, Carol Pirano, and Kim Egger, without whom we would probably be meeting out in the parking lot. Of course, if it were 60 degrees like last night, that might seem okay, but since the temperature dropped by 30 degrees, not such a good idea. So with that, I'm pleased to introduce, to welcome you on behalf of the English department, Jim Phelan, who is Humanities Distinguished Professor at The Ohio State University. Jim?
Good morning and welcome. I'm standing in for Valerie Lee, our chair, who unfortunately is ill and cannot be here. So I guess I would like you to imagine before you not a 6'5" white guy, but a 5'6" African-American woman who speaks not with the voice you hear, but with Valerie's own sort of distinctive African-American woman's Midwestern accent. And I actually feel, although I'm unable to channel Valerie, I will just say that I feel a little bit like the second warm-up act for the Rolling Stones, which is to say that you don't really want to hear me, you want to hear what's coming next. And I say that as a way of sort of trying to suggest something of Valerie's charm and wit, which I don't have. We were once doing a hire in which one of the issues came up about one of our candidates. Well, how charming is this person? And I said, I really can't speak to that. We'll have to ask Valerie. But I do want to say, Valerie and all of us in the English department are delighted to be part of this enterprise. Delighted with the cooperation from the Humanities Institute, and especially grateful for the work of Peter and Saul and Ruth and all of the staff at the center. Peter is much too modest about his role in all this. Without him and without Valerie, we wouldn't be here. And Peter and Saul really have kept us on task and made sure that everything is going to function so well. So we are, again, delighted on behalf of the English department to be participating in this real genuine interdisciplinary effort, and we're looking very much forward to today. Finally, on a personal note, as editor of the journal Narrative, I'm delighted that we're going to do a special issue of papers from the conference, and I very much look forward to working further with each of the contributors. Thank you.
Morning. Thank you all for coming. And I just wanted to thank again, you know, this has been a wonderful experience for me to see how another university works, Ohio State. Both the law school as well as the English department. It's really been tremendous. And I think all of you will enjoy the lineup that we've created, and this morning's panel is particularly interesting. And, of course, a great deal of credit for this panel goes to Ruth Kolker, sitting over there. What this panel is, to begin with, is the legal practice of narrative. So let me first introduce our first speaker, and that is Robert Dinnerstein. He's a professor of law at American University in Washington College of Law. He's also the director of a new disability rights law clinic at American University, and where he's taught since 1983. Before that, he was an attorney in the Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division, in the Special Litigation Section, where he litigated cases concerning conditions in state mental retardation, mental illness, and juvenile institutions. He's also served as the director of the law school as nationally recognized clinical legal program, and he was an associate dean for academic affairs. Among his disability-related activities, he's been on the President's Committee on Mental Retardation, now the President's Committee on Intellectual Disability. He's been a past president of the American Association on Mental Retardation's Legal Process and Advocacy Division, and he was a signatory of the Montreal Declaration on Intellectual Disabilities, as well as a member of the Board of Directors of the Quality Trust for Individuals with Disabilities and Mental Disability Rights International. He's the author of a great many of publications, and some of those in the field of mental disabilities law, as well as the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act, the Interaction Between Disability and Criminal Justice System Disability, and International Human Rights, among other subjects. And finally, he's the co-editor and co-author of A Guide to Consent, which was published in 1999. So without further ado, Bob?
Thank you, Ruth. Some of you heard last night my tale of woe about getting here. I got to the airport, at National Airport in Washington, in plenty of time for my flight, only to find something which had never happened to me before, and that was there were no parking spaces in the entire airport. You can't imagine how frustrating that is. Maybe you can. to be there, to be ready to go, to be all set, and literally not to be able to get here. So I had to go back to my office, rebook, charge Peter a lot of extra money, and finally get here. So I'm really happy to be here. And I start with that also because, as always happens to me when I'm at a conference, as you get close to the time of the conference, everything seems to relate to each other and, of course, makes sense to you in the context of what you're trying to do. So, of course, naturally, there was a disability angle both to my experience at the airport and actually to an earlier experience I had that day as well. At the airport, I was, of course, not the only one in the difficult position of trying to find a place to park, and several of us were queuing up at one of the garages that we thought was the best shot for being able to park, the hourly parking garage, for which I would have paid handsomely. And several of the cars were there, and the people came by and tried to move us along, and indeed threatened to bring the police to ticket us if we didn't move, which, of course, just got my dander up even more. But we're listening there, and we all finally kind of started to move, except the car in back of me, and I could hear this outside of my window, where the driver said, "Listen, I use a wheelchair. You got to find a place for my car." At which point, the supervisor and the other person there were quite attentive to him and went over and were clearly, they were on the walkie-talkie, were going to try to figure out, they understood that they needed to do something a little bit different for this driver because he used a wheelchair. And I thought, well, that's really good. It's good that I resented it a little, but I did understand that it made sense that the airport staff would do this. And it didn't seem, as unfriendly as these folks seemed to be to me, they didn't seem to be resenting this at all. They seemed to understand this was something that simply needed to be done. And I thought, well, isn't that good? That's one of the ways in which I think we've come to understand some of the demands of needs of and demands of people with disabilities. In this case, the one of being able to actually park a car in a place that's accessible to the individual. Earlier that day, I had gone to, this was a long day, I'd gone to the doctor's and had some blood work done. And as I was waiting for the blood work to be done, I was in the outside area. And a man came in, a man I would say in his maybe mid-30s, in a very kind of agitated state. He wanted his blood needed to be tested. It needed to be tested in about a half hour. He said he only had a half hour. He spoke a little bit too loudly, a little bit too insistently. The nurse, who was completely unsympathetic, took his information and just told him to sit down, but you could tell that he was agitated about it. He did sit down. He sat down next to a woman who was also waiting to be taken. He asked her if she was there. I wasn't really trying to eavesdrop, but I was able to hear this conversation. He said, "Are you here for your cholesterol?" She said, "No." He said, "Well, could you look at this form I filled out and tell me if it's done right?" And she looked it up quickly and said, "Well, you know, it seems to be." And in a few minutes, so we're sitting there. I'm reading and getting ready to, hoping that I'll be taken soon. I didn't even know the airport thing was going to happen. And at some point, even though he'd been told to sit down, he came back up to the counter, and he was still a little agitated and said, "You know, I don't have much time. You have to take me. Can I leave my paperwork and come back later?" And they said, "Oh, no, our rules, you can't do that. You have to stay here if you're going to do this." There were other people waiting there. He wanted to make sure that he wasn't getting pushed down on the list since he had been there earlier, and he was arguing with the nurse about that. Anyway, I get taken back to get my blood work done, and I'm talking to the nurse, who was one of the nurses behind the desk, and I just said, "You know, for what it's worth, I think this man probably is a person with mental retardation, just by the way in which he interacted with you." And she said, oh, you mean like schizophrenia? And I said, "Well, no, that's mental illness. That's not the same as mental retardation." So, well, what do you mean? I said, "You know, having a little bit of difficulty thinking, a little bit slower in getting things." She said, "Oh, well, that's okay." And I said, "And one of the things that many people with mental retardation experience is they get very thrown by changes in activities, changes in schedules, so that maybe there was just something about the short time he had available, the other things he needed to do, that just made him a little agitated." And she said, "Well, you know, he comes in here all the time, and he's always yelling at us, and he's really kind of a pain." And I said, "Well, again, you know, there may be other things going on with him." But at that point, she finally got to the point of drawing my blood, and we kind of moved on. As I left and finished my work and went out and got my coat, she called over to me from behind the desk and said, "He left already. You see, he just left." And, of course, that was, at least for the moment, the end of that interaction. And I thought, well, this was a kind of a counterpoint, or became, after the experience at the airport, a counterpoint to how disability plays out. In this case, disability was not a positive trait, or not something that would lead somebody to act in some kind of positive way. Instead of being a trump, as it might have been in the parking situation, it was, first of all, unseen as a concept, and secondly, to the extent it was recognized at all, it came across as inconvenient, as reflecting the person's basic inability to understand the most simple kind of direction. And that, to me, it kind of captures part of the problem in thinking about disability and what it means in society generally, and in particular in the context of cases and litigation, which is what I'm to be talking about. When you think of, say, other groups, either identity groups or racial minority groups or whatever, there may come to mind an image of who you're thinking about when you just hear the term. If you hear African American, we just heard, for example, African American professor, 5'6". And I suspect if we hear that and don't know this person, a sort of an image comes to mind of who that person might be. And we heard something about her personality, too. Well, when you hear the word disability, it conjures up really a multitude of images. In many ways, some positive, some negative, some seemingly positive, but with the seeds of something that actually can be negative. There are also, of course, it is not it is a capacious category. It is not one category, as we all know. So when you hear disability, you could hear physical disability or mental disability. You could hear mental retardation or mental illness. You could hear deafness or autism. You could hear congenital disabilities or disabilities that develop later in life after an accident or trauma. You could hear alcoholism or quadriplegia. You could hear obvious or non-obvious disabilities. You could hear single or multiple disabilities, and the list could go on. So that these differences not only suggest, as certainly has been true historically, the challenges of political coordination and making sure that people with disabilities who have common interests are speaking with one voice, but also just challenge any sense that there's somehow a master narrative that somehow can function in disability cases. And of course, I don't think it'll be any surprise to you all to conclude that there really isn't such a master narrative. My task this morning is to talk about the role of disability narratives in litigation. It's a pretty complex task, and one which I really can't do justice in the allotted time I've got. So rather, I want to attempt a comprehensive assessment of the role of narrative in disability cases. I want to start with some general observations about the nature of disability litigation narratives, the barriers to what I would call the narrative coherence that are created because of the way courts respond to disability narratives, especially the Supreme Court. And finally, the possibilities that narratives can present for expansion of the rights of people with disabilities. Of course, before we even get to litigation, there's the kind of non-litigation or pre-litigation kinds of narratives that are out there in the world. And again, some of which are working at cross purposes with each other. These are narratives that include the following: that the person with a disability is pitiable, is somebody who's deserving of protection, but is not entitled to respect or dignity. That the person with a disability is somebody who's dependent, who's damaged in some kind of way, a spoiled identity concept. That the person with a disability is blameworthy in some sense for his or her condition. That the person with a disability is suffering from a problem that's a medical problem and that lends itself to being solved through medical intervention or not. That the person with a disability is a special pleader along with other identity groups and maybe even seen as unfairly doing so. That the person with a disability is hypersexual or is asexual. That the person with a disability is an overcomer, a superachiever. That the person with a disability is a hard worker, is thankful for the opportunity to be productive and takes advantage of those opportunities. That the person with a disability is a rights-bearing individual. That the person with a disability is limited more by the interactions with other people and with his or her environment than by any condition that is solely located within him or herself, the social construction model. And that the person with a disability is somebody who has strengths as well as weaknesses and is more than simply a person with the disability he or she happens to have. So how do these kinds of narratives and others that I'm sure you could generate get translated in both positive and negative ways into litigation? Well, first, let me point out some things that certainly would be obvious to the lawyers among us, maybe less so to those from a literature background. Narratives are always going to be mediated, but within a court system, they are mediated through multiple structures. In the first instance, of course, there's the interaction between the lawyer and the person with a disability or the client to produce a narrative that both captures the person's experience and that will satisfy the criteria that are established by the relevant legal doctrine. In the Americans with Disabilities statute, Title I, which is the employment discrimination statute, the desire of the job candidate to demonstrate that he or she can perform the job in question and that his or her disability does not limit him runs up against the ADA's definition of disability, which is that an individual must have a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. Of course, if the client's narrative overemphasizes his or her ability to overcome limitations, to be able to do the job, to function as he or she might, runs up against the problem of the court saying, well, then you're not substantially limited. And not only do you lose on the merits, but more significantly, you don't even get to bring your case on the merits because your case is thrown out at an early stage in summary judgment. This represents, I think, if we gave a book title to disability narratives, it would have to be the Catch-22 book by Joseph Heller, because the ADA is rife with multiple Catch-22s, and this is one of the most significant ones. Even beyond this potential conflict between a client's experience of disability and the doctrine that requires a shaping of that, there's a very real problem of lawyers' ability or inability to hear a client's narrative without imposing a set of limitations or assumptions that rob the narratives of their meaning. For example, a lawyer for a criminal defendant with intellectual disabilities or mental retardation must understand the ways in which a defendant's intellectual disabilities can affect the extent to which he is subject to the suggestions of others, whether it's an accomplice or a police interrogator or the lawyer him or herself, as well as the tendency of many such clients to work very hard to hide their disability altogether, even when it might be useful to them in their cases. Like many clinical law teachers in the United States, I teach a client-centered kind of counseling, a client approach to lawyering, which really takes the client's experience as the starting point and says that one should represent zealously a client's expressed goals and interests. But a lawyer who is imbued with his or her own sense of power and a sense that he or she should be paternalistic towards his or her client and knows what's best for the client may interact with the client in a way that doesn't permit the client to express his or her capacity in the way that he or she has the ability to do, and therefore replicates within the representation the very things that you're trying to overcome in the litigation itself. Of course, the person with a disability, the narrative of the person with a disability also may be compromised by the fact that it may be his or her narrative may be presented not by the person himself, but rather by someone else, mediated through the intervention of another. It may be a prosecutor presenting a narrative of a disability case where the person with a disability is the complainant or the victim, but isn't able to tell his or her story directly, must do so through a prosecutor. The infamous Glen Ridge, New Jersey case some years ago with a young woman who was sodomized in a quite awful way by a group of teenagers who knew her, who had grown up with her, is one such case where the tension between what the prosecutor wants to show, which is that this young woman was incapable of consenting to sexual relations and consequently this should have upgraded the level of criminality of the defendants, with the notion that, in fact, had situations been different, she might well have been able to consent in truly consensual sex and not to this forced sex that she was subjected to. The prosecutor has an interest in trying to get a conviction, may push the narrative in a way that's different from the way the individual would want to portray herself or how her allies would want to portray herself. As Ruth mentioned, my prior background was handling cases on behalf of people in institutions, often people with mental retardation in particular. And many of those individuals were not in a position to really tell their story as one might want to in a narrative context. That story got told through other people. It got told through expert witnesses. It got told through staff people who were overcome with the sense of degradation that they were participating in. It got told in many different ways, and yet it wasn't necessarily the narrative that people would tell about themselves. And maybe as a consequence didn't capture some full reality of what might be going on. Of course, the narrative also doesn't stand alone because in a litigation, it's a contested narrative. You're up against another side, which wants to tell a narrative that challenges the narrative that you are presenting and will present, consequently, different perspective on what you're doing. So it's not as simply getting up and saying, here's what happened, even here's what happened from my perspective. That narrative gets challenged. It gets challenged by cross-examination. It gets challenged by other witnesses who are coming forward. Once the narrative is produced, of course, there's a question of who's believing it. In a case, you try a case before a judge or a jury, consider the trier of fact, that person has to understand your narrative. And that's something where the general misunderstanding or lack of understanding that many people in society have about disability affects the extent to which a narrative can be persuasive. And this is particularly true of, I would say, that lack of understanding. It's particularly true when you look at what the Supreme Court has done in recent years with respect to disability cases. And I won't have time to catalog this all, but really the number of cases in which I would say the Supreme Court gets it wrong are almost limitless. And they get it wrong and sometimes in ways that are not even central to the decision. In 1982, the Supreme Court decided a case called Youngberg versus Romeo, which was about conditions of confinement for a person who was in an institution in Pennsylvania, the Pennhurst State School and Hospital, an infamous institution which has since been closed. And in the course of talking about what Nicholas Romeo, the named plaintiff in that case, was entitled to, food, clothing, shelter, medical care, freedom from harm, and some limited amount of training, the court said, now, of course, Nicholas Romeo, who was at that time characterized as having profound mental retardation. Of course, he will never live in the community, so it's all just about what level of liberty he has within the institution. Well, within a few months after the decision, Nicholas Romeo did move to the community and lived in the community, even though the court didn't seem to think that was even possible. So clearly the court was wrong about that. Clearly the court is wrong in a case like Chevron versus Etchezabal regarding whether or not it's paternalistic or acceptable to not employ an individual in a work situation because he might be a direct threat to himself, even though he's been working for a subcontractor for 20 years without incident. And as the court tried to, and I went to the oral argument in this case, as the court thought about the role of an employer in interacting with a person with a disability, several of the justices could not get beyond the fact, well, why would you hire somebody who simply wants to commit suicide by working in a place that's dangerous to him? Well, maybe you want to hire somebody who actually is trying to put bread on the table for his or her family. Court didn't seem to get that. Court didn't seem to get the fact that when a young person is in some kind of psychiatric distress and someone thinks he or she ought to be in a mental hospital, that a parent simply volunteering his child into the hospital might be seen by the child as something that was quite problematic. The court called that an overdose of due process to provide a hearing in that case. Again, one could go on and on as to the ways in which the court has gotten it wrong, not only in the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is, I think, what we tend to focus on particularly now, but in other kinds of cases, too. Now, the court does get it right sometimes, too. It's not completely unable to get this. It's interesting to see when they get it right and how they get it right. They get it right when, for example, Justice Thurgood Marshall writes a concurring opinion in the Cleburne case in 1985 concerning location of a group home in the community and speaks to the experience that people with mental retardation have and the discrimination that they've suffered. I think not by chance that Justice Marshall would understand that because of his both personal and professional experience. They seem to get it right with respect to whether the death penalty is an appropriate form of punishment for people, for defendants with mental retardation. And what they seem to get right in that case was understanding that even though a defendant with mental retardation may be competent to stand trial, may be properly subject to punishment, there may be something about the level of moral understanding that would say even if the death penalty were otherwise legitimate, it's not legitimate for individuals who have this condition as a group. So maybe they got it right there. Maybe they got it right in the Tennessee versus Lane case, which actually followed a case that got it wrong in the Garrett case, and that is that when an individual has a criminal case and has to crawl up the stairs to get into the courtroom where his case is to be adjudicated, then maybe there's something a little bit wrong with that. Maybe there's something that amounts to discrimination in that kind of case. Okay, so they get it right sometimes, they get it wrong sometimes. Narrative can play a role in trying to make it right more than it's wrong, which is obviously something we need to be doing. So how do we try to approach this issue? How do we make our narratives better, more effective, that is? Well, I think there's several things we can say. One is, clearly, people who care about people with disabilities themselves, need to be involved in an ongoing, broad effort to educate society generally about disability and the role it plays in society. That includes judges, because if judges have some prior understandings of and connections to people with disabilities, they may hear what's going on in their cases in a very different way. It is true, I think, at least for many people in law who wind up specializing in the area of disability law, and it's certainly true for me, that the reason they do it is at least partly based on their own personal experiences, either with disabilities themselves or with close family members who have disabilities. And in my case, I have a sister who has mental retardation, and I learned a lot about disability through her without knowing I was learning it in that way. I also learned that it's actually possible to still like Barry Manilow at the age of 50, which my sister does. And one of the things I learned is my sister could be a pain in the neck even though she has a disability, and she could be wonderful even though she has a disability. So learning more about disability is important. Learning that certain hypotheses are out there and it need to be challenged. I keep waiting for the headline in the newspapers that will say, man kills individual on train tracks, no finding of past mental health history involved. Of course, we don't see that. What we see is when there is some kind of mental illness, some kind of hospitalization, is a prominent factor, thought to be prominent. We need lawyers, well, I don't know if we need lawyers, but we need lawyers who represent people with disabilities to be able to listen well to their clients, to collaborate with their clients, as I said earlier, not to replicate the very problems they're trying to address. We need to find opportunities for people with disabilities to work in concert with other people with disabilities. And for those of us who are lawyers, we need to work closely with self-advocates, psychiatric survivors, others who have the experience of disability can tell us their sense of what that means and inform our advocacy and our use of their narratives. We have to recognize that sometimes disability should matter a great deal in our societal interventions, and sometimes it shouldn't matter at all. We have to be aware that rules that are designed to protect people with disabilities, for example, by requiring them to have a lot of knowledge before they engage in sexual intercourse, which is something that might happen with an individual with mental retardation in a group home, maybe like the literacy test that was used in the South to keep black people from voting. That is, it may set up standards that many of us would not be able to meet, not just people with disabilities. We need to be aware that there is and continues to be a strong distrust of disability. And I would suggest that the ADA reflects that distrust in this way. We distrust the sort of open-ended, broad question of, do you have a disability? Because we think, rightly, that historically that information has been used not to empower people, but to limit people. And it would be nice if we got to the point where instead of feeling that way about disability, we saw disability as something to be honored, to be celebrated, as something that's a good thing, a sort of an affirmative thing, if you want to think about it that way. We need to understand the sense in which autonomy, something we care a lot about if we don't have disabilities, is something that people with disabilities care about too. And yet, we also have to understand that autonomy need not be isolated individualism, but can be the autonomy that comes from strong connections with others in one's life, family, staff, and the like. We need to think about promoting narratives of disability that talk not just about what a person with a disability needs, but how society can be reformed and reshaped in ways that benefit people without disabilities just as they benefit people with disabilities. So that rather than seeing things in a kind of zero-sum or limited-sum game, we can see them as, gee, a curb cut helps the parent with a stroller just as much as it helps the person who's a wheelchair user. And so my final point would be this. Litigation, which is lifeblood for lawyers, or at least for many lawyers, is a wonderful thing sometimes, although most people will tell you mostly bad things can happen if you're contemplating litigation. It is better if it is in service of a broader set of ideals, a raising of consciousness about rights, a tool that may get people to do the things they should do anyway, but they wouldn't do without the hammer or the threatened hammer of litigation. Narratives have to be understood in that kind of context to use litigation as a tool and not to be the end in and of itself. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob. I'm sure you've given us a great deal to think about, and I'm sure we'll have time to discuss this at the end. It's my great pleasure now to introduce Andy Imparato, who is the President and CEO of American Association of People with Disabilities, which is the largest member organization in the United States for people with all different types of disabilities. He's worked also as an attorney with the National Council on Disabilities, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Disability Policy before joining the AAPD. And he's called upon very frequently, and today is one of those days, to provide testimony as well as to speak about all sorts of issues affecting Americans with disabilities. And one last note, his perspective is informed by his own experience, as so much of us have different experiences with bipolar disorder. So, Andy, thank you.
Thank you. Can the folks in the back hear me okay? Good.
Okay.
Is this better?
Yes.
Or I'll just speak up too. But yeah, this, it's not clear to me that the microphone is on, but I'll speak loud. And if, okay, good. First, let me just thank Paul Miller, who was supposed to do this, for recommending me. Unfortunately, Paul's dealing with some personal health issues, which happens to a lot of us with disabilities, but it was a good opportunity for me to come and be with you. Just to fill in a little bit of my background, I've worked in all three branches of the federal government, and the topic of this panel is legal practice. You've heard from Bob about practice in the courts. I'm going to focus more on public policy advocacy outside of the courts, focused on the executive branch or the legislative branch. And as was mentioned in my introduction, I have bipolar disorder, or manic depression. I graduated from law school in 1990, and my disability kind of started to kick in during my last semester of law school. It settled into a pattern for me where I go about 6 months where I have a lot of energy, a lot of self-confidence, not a lot of patience, followed by 6 months where my energy goes down, self-confidence goes down. And as is true with people with lots of disability labels, it's idiosyncratic. The stability of my disability is not true for everybody that has that label of bipolar disorder. But I benefited a lot from being exposed to a narrative about disability early in my own adjustment to my disability and early in my career as a lawyer. My first job after clerking for a judge for a year was working at the Disability Law Center in Boston. And I was around a lot of disability leaders in Massachusetts who were comfortable self-identifying and who helped me to understand that my disability could be a source of strength and identity and connection to the client constituency that I was working with, and not as something that I needed to hide or be ashamed of or be afraid to put on a job application. So I feel like that's an important piece of this discussion of narrative. How can we expose people to a positive narrative about disability as they're adjusting to their own status? Could be somebody that's born with a disability and is coming of age, or it could be somebody that acquires a disability or new disabilities as they age. And Massachusetts was just a great place for me to get oriented. I continue to feel that the disability community there is healthier and works together effectively in ways that I haven't seen consistently in other states. So I was glad I was exposed to kind of cross-disability collaboration early in my career. So I want to just touch a little bit on the importance of personal narrative, especially for people with non-apparent disabilities. I find that it's very important that I self-identify a lot when I'm speaking to audiences, when I'm in meetings. I do it with folks in the business community, with folks in the policy community, and I do it for a few reasons. One is that it does establish credibility. I find people listen better and more to what I'm saying when I self-identify and share a personal experience. Another is that it moves the discussion from the abstract to the personal. I think one of the challenges that we face in the disability field is our issues sometimes get thought about as abstract issues, as political correctness run amok. People don't always think of them in personal ways, feel the issues in their hearts. And from my perspective, that's part of being an effective advocate, is getting people out of their heads and reaching them at more of a gut level when you're discussing policy challenges. A third reason to self-identify is that it can create a connection to policymakers or their staff, to coalition partners, to media, and even to others who experience other types of discrimination. And I have found that it's very hard for me to predict who is going to feel a personal connection when I self-identify with my own disability, and I've found allies in lots of strange places by doing that. I remember we were working with some folks at Merrill Lynch around a hiring initiative, and when I self-identified as having bipolar disorder, one of the kind of our main contact left the room at one point, and his colleague, who was his boss, opened up his briefcase while his colleague was out of the room and showed me all the medications that he was taking. And I think for him, it was important to show that connection, and I don't know that he would have done that if I hadn't been as comfortable and open about my own experience. It's also an opportunity to educate, to change attitudes, and to create a safe space for others to self-identify. And I continue to be amazed how many people there are who work in the disability rights field who don't feel completely comfortable or safe self-identifying with their own conditions. And I think that's one of our challenges as a movement. How can we create a safer space for folks to do that? There are certainly negatives to self-identifying, and I want to mention some that I've experienced. One, and this was particularly true when I worked in the government, one's objectivity can be questioned, especially if you're expected to be in a neutral role. So just as an example, when I worked at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, I can remember one time my boss, Paul Miller, who's a fellow disability advocate who has a visible disability, he's a little person, He also has non-visible disabilities, including his personal experience with cancer. But Paul, at one point, felt like he needed to sit me down and have lunch with me and convince me to stop referring to myself as an advocate. And from his perspective, we weren't going to be as effective in our role at the EEOC if people saw us as biased. And, you know, my reaction to that was, well, you know, the EEOC has a mission. The mission is to promote civil rights in the workplace. Why can't we be an advocate for that mission? And why is that implying a bias? But I think when one self-identifies or wears one's disability on one's sleeve, there is a tendency for some folks to start to question how objective you're going to be or fair you're going to be in dealing with a tough policy issue. And I'm not saying that any of these reasons are good reasons not to self-identify. I'm just saying these are some of the things we run into. Another is people can challenge your qualifications, and this goes to the catch-22 that Bob was talking about. Just to share a quick personal experience, when I was finishing my job at the Disability Law Center, I applied for a job at a national organization in Washington that did advocacy for people with mental disabilities, and in my cover letter, I self-identified as a mental health consumer. The person who was screening the resumes called up one of my references and talked to them about, you know, he says he's a mental health consumer. Can you tell me, you know, a little bit more about that? And she said, well, you should really talk to him about that. So they ended up interviewing me, and we went through the whole interview. The topic did not come up. So at the end of the interview, I said, I know you talked to one of my references about me being a mental health consumer. You know, I want to take this opportunity to answer any questions you might have. The lawyer who had talked to the reference basically said nothing, and I think was embarrassed. That was illegal under the Americans with Disabilities Act to do that. And keep in mind, this was one of the nationally recognized leaders in advocating for civil rights for people with disabilities. His colleague, who also was a nationally recognized and is a nationally recognized leader, said, well, is there anything you want to tell us, Andy? And I talked a little bit about my disability, and her initial reaction was, oh, come on, Andy, we all see a therapist. Why is that relevant? And I took that as kind of a challenge to whether this was a real thing or a serious thing that I was dealing with. So I shared some aspects that I wouldn't necessarily share in a job interview, but just to try to establish the severity or significance of the disability. And then she talked about a worker they had who was bipolar, who was inappropriate at staff meetings. And she was kind of concerned about how this was going to play out at staff meetings. And I tell that story because I think it's not uncommon for people with non-visible disabilities or non-apparent disabilities to run into that catch-22 where either it's not significant enough to matter, so kind of get over it or stop emphasizing it so much, or it's so significant that you're not qualified for whatever it is you're trying to do. And I think one of our challenges in the disability field is to establish, again, it's kind of like establishing a safe space, but to establish a wide area where, yes, it's relevant, and yes, you're qualified. And it can be hard for some people to understand that. And the last reason that self-identifying can be a challenge is that I think sometimes it can lead to an us versus them division. The reality is disability is on a continuum. There's not a bright line where somebody becomes disabled. At AAPD, when we run programs for people with disabilities like our internship programs where people work on the Hill or in the branches of government, we simply ask them, do you self-identify as a person with a disability? And if they say yes, we don't ask any follow-up questions in terms of what it is. We don't ask for medical documentation. And we do that in part because we view disability almost as more of a political statement than a medical statement. If somebody feels comfortable self-identifying and sees a connection between themselves and others who have that label, then we welcome them to be part of what we're trying to do. And I think as a movement, we have that challenge. And you're right, Bob, that it's reflected in the ADA and lots of other laws, the Social Security laws, where we're trying to draw this bright line about the truly disabled. And sometimes it's drawing a bright line around the deserving poor or the deserving people of support and the folks who are just lazy or just trying to get a leg up, like maybe the guy behind you in the parking lot really didn't need that parking space. So
So I think, you know, the us versus them sometimes can get us into trouble, and these are all tensions that we live with in this field. I want to just touch briefly on some ways that I've tried to use narrative doing advocacy, public policy advocacy. One thing that we've tried to do to respond to what the Supreme Court has done, particularly with the definition of disability, is call for legislation that would restore protections for people with chronic health conditions who have been kind of disproportionately left out thanks to the way the Supreme Court has interpreted the ADA. And in calling for that restoration, I talk a lot about Tony Coelho, one of the authors of the ADA, who has epilepsy and who arguably would be found by a lot of courts to be outside the scope of the protected class, or Bob Dole, another person who functions well notwithstanding his disability and some people might find to be outside the protected class if he were to challenge discrimination. Stories from case law can also be used to illustrate what the shrinking definition means for real people, especially in the employment context. I've also used narratives in talking about how genetic technologies are going to be used and some of the tensions or challenges as the Human Genome Project does its work and we get more and more information about our genetic makeup. When I testified in front of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee about the need for legislation that would protect people against discrimination on the basis of genetic information, I talked about my own experience with bipolar disorder, which is a condition that a lot of people think has a strong genetic link, and I talked about my two sons and how they may or may not have a gene for bipolar disorder and a concern that they not experience discrimination in health insurance or employment based on their genetic makeup. And I think some of the members of the committee listened more carefully to what I had to say on that topic than they might have if I hadn't talked about the personal experience. I also think that the genetic non-discrimination issue is a back doorway to illustrate the need to fix the ADA. If the genetic legislation passes, it basically protects people who have a genetic predisposition but who haven't experienced any symptoms. When you start experiencing symptoms, you lose protections under the genetic non-discrimination legislation, but your protections under the ADA don't kick in if you're able to manage those symptoms and they don't become substantially limiting in a major life activity. Now, you could argue that you still have protections under the ADA under the regarded as prong of the definition, but that's been interpreted by the courts very narrowly. So, again, if you talk about my children as your example, they'll have protections until they have their first episode of depression or episode of hypomania or the high end of bipolar disorder. Those protections will last as long as the condition is out of control. If they're able to control their condition and manage it to the point that it's not substantially limiting them in a major life activity, they're still very vulnerable to experiencing discrimination based on the label. But their protections, given what the Supreme Court has done to the ADA, are not likely to be there if they need them. So again, if you bring this stuff down to real people that may experience discrimination, sometimes it's easier for policymakers to get the need for the change. Another example that I've spent a lot of energy on is trying to reform our largest disability programs. We've talked about the Americans with Disabilities Act. From my perspective, that law has a vision based on things like equality of opportunity, full participation, independent living, and economic self-sufficiency. Most of the dollars we spend in the federal government on people with disabilities flow through four programs: Social Security Disability Insurance, Supplemental Security Income, Medicaid, and Medicare. The vision of those programs predated the ADA, and to a large extent, they expect people with disabilities to be outside the workforce, to be living in poverty, and punish people with disabilities as they acquire assets or jobs. That's a big challenge that we face, and I think it reflects an outdated narrative about the opportunities that people with disabilities have and should expect for themselves. I wanted to close just by comparing the disability rights narrative with some competing narratives. I think Bob did a good job of touching on some of these. Bob said that there is no master narrative for disability. I would argue the closest thing we have to a master narrative is the idea that disability is a natural part of the human experience that in no way limits a person's right to make choices, to pursue a meaningful career, and to participate fully in all aspects of society. That is a broad concept that speaks to the experience of people with a lot of different types of disabilities. And I think that there are some competing narratives to that that are still dominant narratives in the public consciousness around disability. I would say the number one competing narrative talks about disability as a pathology that needs to be wiped out. I just went to see an exhibit at the Holocaust Museum that is called Deadly Medicine, but it's basically about eugenics in Germany. But the interesting thing to me is going through that exhibit and seeing the language that was used to talk about people with disabilities in the U.S. and in Germany and other parts of the world in the 1930s and 40s, some of that is not that different than modern literature from the March of Dimes talking about the importance of eliminating birth defects. Public health as a field, to me, uses a narrative to talk about disability that can be very strongly competing with the narrative that says that disability is a natural part of the human experience. And I think you know, it's not popular to say that, but the public health way of thinking about disability is crystal clear to me. That's still the dominant way of thinking about it in American culture. I don't know how many of you watched the presidential debates, but the one time disability got mentioned in three debates was a question about stem cell research. For a lot of people, and it's interesting, for our congressional internship program, two of the folks that are going to be working on the Hill this summer, we asked them, these are for college students with disabilities, what's your number one policy issue that you want to work on? Two of them said stem cell research. For a lot of folks, that's the dominant issue. We need to find medical cures for disabilities and debilitating conditions, and that affects the way a lot of people think about disability. Another competing narrative is that people with disabilities are a vulnerable group in need of protection. That comes up a lot in budget fights. When we're trying to defend the Medicaid budget, we talk about how vulnerable we are. When we're trying to get funding for protection and advocacy services for people with disabilities, we talk about the vulnerability. In death penalty fights, we bring up how vulnerable people with mental disabilities are and why the death penalty shouldn't be applied to that population. I'm not saying that those are bad strategies, but they do affect the narrative. They do affect the way people with disabilities get perceived. Another important competing narrative that came up a lot in the Terri Schiavo case is the narrative that pits religious conservatives against pro-science progressives, and a disability rights perspective on issues at the end of life or the beginning of life often gets lost in that debate. It's hard for the press and the public to understand a progressive position that would defend Terri Schiavo being kept alive. I feel like that perspective in the Schiavo debate got lost. There are strong disability advocates who came down on both sides of that, the particular facts of that case. My point is that neither of their disability-grounded perspectives were an important part of the discussion of that case. And then the last couple of narratives I wanted to touch on. One is that people with disabilities are an expensive group that's not always worth the investment. An example of that was when Oregon, in the context of trying to ration their health care and their Medicaid program, were going to decide what procedures to pay for based on the quality-adjusted life years of the person after the procedure. So if they were going to be living with a disability and their quality of life wasn't very high, maybe it wasn't worth paying for the procedure in the first place. I think there are a lot of folks that continue to have those concerns. And finally, the idea that disability is a fire hazard or a threat to public safety. And that can come up for people with all different types of disabilities. On the mental health side, we're dangerous. You know, you talked about the headlines around murderers. If they have a history of mental illness, well, of course, that's why they did the violent act, even though there's not a correlation between a mental health diagnosis and a propensity to violence. And people with psychiatric disabilities are more likely to be victims than they are to be perpetrators of violent crimes. So, you know, I guess I would close just by saying, for me, we were asked on this panel to talk about narrative in the context of legal advocacy, but I would say the most important audience for our narrative is not policymakers, It's people with disabilities and the key influencers in their lives, their parents, their best friends, their spouses. If we can change the way people with disabilities think about themselves and talk about themselves, and we can change the way their key influencers and allies and loved ones think about and talk about them, to me, that's how we're fundamentally going to change the bigger narrative that's going on in society. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andy, for that riveting talk about disabilities. And we have a few minutes for questions, so if they can direct the questions to the different speakers, that would be terrific. We have microphones down here, and Ruth's going to handle one, Scott's going to handle the other. Do you want to raise your hand if there are questions in the back?
I'll try to speak, because I have a question. Can you use the microphone?
Okay.
Hi, I'm Itka Srinska from Syracuse University. I have a question for Andy. You talk about disclosure and how important it is to disclose that you have disability. And I'm wondering, certainly there are some barriers where you just don't want to disclose it because you know that it's not going to benefit you, right? And the example I want to raise is, as a lawyer, you have to pass the bar exam. And there is this question, not at all states, though, that ask if you ever had some sort of therapy or if you have to ever go to see a therapist in your life. And you have to tell the truth, and you know that it's not going to help you. So how would you react to that as a, you know, lawyer, and how can you challenge that? And I think it's illegal in that sense, and it's disability discrimination. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great question, and that practice has been challenged successfully in some states. I remember when Julie Clark was working at the Bazelon for Center for Mental Health Law, she took the bar in Virginia, and they asked that question, and she challenged it, and I think the Bazelon Center represented her in that case, and she was successful. But it is a problem. I think part of the reason that we have that problem is the notion that lawyers are somehow in a category where certain types of human diversity are not okay. So if you're a lawyer, you're not supposed to get depressed, and if you do get depressed, how is that going to affect your ability to represent your client? I can just share one positive experience I had. When I told my mentor from law school, Gerald Gunther, that I had bipolar disorder, his reaction, he didn't miss a beat, he said, "You're in good company." And he had just written a biography of Learned Hand, and from his perspective, it was clear to him, studying Learned Hand's life, that he dealt with mood disorders and quite likely had some form of bipolar disorder. So I think one of our challenges in the legal profession is how can we create a safe space for more lawyers and judges and law professors to be open about their own experience with these conditions and to talk about, to the extent that it can be thought of as a positive in terms of their ability to understand their client's situation and to be an effective advocate on behalf of their clients. The reality is that their depression is incredibly high incidence. And from, you know, my experience, it's even more high incidence among attorneys. Most lawyers hate their jobs. A lot of them get depressed in the context of, you know, just working in a big law firm. And if they're in an environment where it's not safe to talk about it, that's just going to take that bad situation and make it worse. So I think, you know, I would kind of come at it that what's the advantage to the legal profession of making it safe and desirable for people to talk about their own experience? And I think people here know the ABA is going to have a conference in May for lawyers with disabilities, and I'm hoping this is a theme, and this issue of questions that are asked on bar, you know, qualifying for the bar, will come up in the context of that conference.
Thank you. My question, or not question really, is comment that when my daughter was in middle school, my daughter, who has a limited disability in that she slowed down a bit by CP on her right, affecting her right side, arm and leg, and there was fire drill, and a goofy principal asked her and another girl, who had a similar disability, really not slowed down significantly at all, to step back and wait till everyone else had moved ahead. And somehow that just didn't strike me as being right. And so I called the school and told them, that I felt my daughter's life was worth just as much as everyone else's. But there would be times when people would be slowed down, a majority of the people would be slowed down by people who can't move with the pack. And so I wonder what is a good way to handle that. As a parent, I couldn't be objective. You know, I was on fire. But there are, if I'm more rational, step back, I realize that that can be an important issue. And I just wonder, get some feedback on that.
Well, a few years ago, I tore my ACL in my knee, and I was on crutches, which is also very humbling if you've been doing this work and don't have a disability, and then you get hit with some temporary disability, and all of a sudden you really start to, even in a minimal way, experience what it's like. And one of the things that happened was we had a fire drill, and I was on crutches, and I was trying to figure out what am I supposed to do when there's a fire drill and you're told to go down the stairs. So I asked about it. I hadn't been motivated before that to really know, but now I was. And I was told, well, you go find Eugene. I said, well, who's Eugene? Well, Eugene is somebody who worked in the janitorial group, and he would, take you down, if need be, carry you down. So they would take care of you. Well, and I said, well, how do we know to get Eugene? Well, you would just know. Well, what if Eugene's not in that? I mean, all the kind of questions that if it really matters to you, as it did, you start asking. And so one of the things is you want people to start thinking about the fact that within their milieu, whether it's a school or the workplace or a public accommodation, we have people with disabilities. We need to think about the fact that they may have different kinds of needs. We need to do something which the ADA and many other disability statutes talk about, provide a reasonable accommodation, a reasonable modification of practices. If something doesn't work for somebody who has a disability, we need to figure out a way to make it work for them. And that may be different in different circumstances. So I think, as you say, maybe in some cases they would take your daughter down first to make sure that it didn't create a problem later. But clearly the one thing they can't do legitimately is to say, it's your problem, not theirs, or we didn't think about that, and I guess we'll have to. They really need to think in the front end, and they need to talk to people with disabilities or family members of people with disabilities to educate themselves about what needs to be done.
Did you want to share something on that question? Oh, okay. We can repeat the question if you want. So just to repeat the question, then the question is, in the context of Ohio fighting the fight to get the increases that are going on in nursing homes spending to stop and to get more spending in home and community-based services for people that need long-term services and supports, how can we change that dynamic using narrative? Is that okay? One thing that your question brings up for me that we haven't really touched on but I think is important is sometimes on policy issues the messenger is as important as the message or more important. So one of the things I'd be looking for on that issue is which messengers are going to resonate the most on that issue with the policymakers, with the media, with the general public. One messenger who I think is very articulate on that issue and who may play well in Ohio is the current governor of Idaho, Dirk Kempthorne, who's a Republican, who has a very good message about home and community-based services and supports. The current head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services talks a lot in his public speaking about the need to end the institutional bias. I'd be looking for a way to get him to Ohio and to deliver that message to some of the policymakers and media here. But I think part of it is if our strategy is not working, it may be that our message is fine, but we need new messengers, and I think that can be part of the narrative discussion.
I would just add that again, if we think about different narratives, there's the narrative that it's the right thing to do for people to be able to live in their homes, which is what everyone else wants, and not to live in institutions. There's also the it will save money in the long run narrative. And of course, you know from particular context you have as to who's going to be more amenable to which of those narratives. Some people, to quote the Supreme Court, can be quite hard-hearted and maybe hard-headed on these issues, but they may in fact respond positively to the financial side. And the third is this, and certainly my experience doing institutional litigation reflects this. Sometimes you just have to bring up all the horror stories of nursing homes or other institutions and really hit them between the eyes to say, this is not right. You wouldn't want to live there. You wouldn't want your loved ones to live there. And there's an alternative to it that's much more humane. We weren't going to be able to persuade judges in the late 1970s that living in the community was a necessary thing for people with mental retardation. But we got to persuade them when we showed them how awful it was to live in places like Willowbrook and Partlow and Pennhurst. That got their attention, and then they were more amenable to thinking, you know, there's got to be some way better to deal with this.
I think we have time for one more question.
My question... Okay. My question is closely related to that. It has to do with the presence or absence of the notion of budget constraints or resource constraints as such. That is... people, if you formulate disability coverage or whatever as a right, then and talk about it as a right, you don't create any space to say, but we don't have any money for that. And a poorer society, for example, might have different arguments than ours does at this time. And I ask my question in the sense of if you're having a conversation with an everyday person and you're trying to formulate public legitimacy for public policy at the higher level, how do I talk to somebody about disability rights and what have you without addressing how much money we're willing to spend on it relative to other things? Am I making a sensible question?
It's very sensible. And, you know, as was said earlier, I have a disability clinic now in Washington, D.C., where my law school is, and we do special education cases right now. And under the statute, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the presumption is that kids who need special education will be, in the first instance, educated within the regular classroom or, if necessary, pulled out only to the degree needed. But if the school district cannot provide a free and appropriate public education, a parent is entitled to seek private school placement at public expense. And in the District of Columbia, many parents take advantage of that. That's very costly. It would be much less costly if the District of Columbia could figure out a way to provide those services in the school district, which is what the statute actually contemplates. Sometimes the issue is not overall how much money, but could you save money in the long run by a certain upfront expenditure? And that may have to do with creating community-based opportunities, or it may have to do with schools. The other thing is that statutes like the ADA and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act do provide for defenses concerning undue hardship or undue burden, which can be both financial and administrative. So I think when the ADA was being debated in its early, right before it's passed and right after, the worry that many defendants or employers, I should say, or providers of accommodations had was, my God, providing reasonable accommodations, that's going to be incredibly expensive. How are we going to be able to do that? What are the limits? Well, we learned a few things. One, most accommodations are quite inexpensive. So we need to make that claim when that's true. Secondly, if it truly is overwhelming financially, then the employer or the provider of service has an opportunity to make that case. But what we learn is that sometimes it's not a very well thought out case. It's maybe less expensive than it's really thought to be. And lastly, as I was saying earlier, insofar as we can craft solutions that are not just for a group of people who have a label of disability, but are for broader groups in society, I think we can talk about spreading the cost and not having it be seen as, do I spend a lot of money on this population for something that I don't see why it's so necessary, of course, versus providing a broader set of things that might be advantageous to many people.
I guess all I would add is I think that a lot of the disability rights laws are more inherently compromised than other civil rights laws. We like putting in things like reasonable accommodation and undue burden defenses and direct threat defenses because it helps us sell the laws to policymakers and to the business community, but then it makes the laws, in my mind, more difficult to enforce to get the kind of broad social change that we're looking for. It's very interesting if you look at the Olmstead Supreme Court decision around the right to receive services in an integrated setting. This dealt with people living in institutions. The trial court, the district court decision, was very strong. The state had very little outs when they were serving somebody in an institution who could have been served in the community. You get to the 11th Circuit, they start putting in qualifiers. You get to the Supreme Court, there are lots of qualifiers. So we've found our rights get diminished even beyond the compromises that were made to get the laws passed. And to me, that's a challenge to us politically. Do we have enough power to have rights that don't have all the asterisks and qualifiers that our rights currently have? And that's why at APD we spend a lot of time trying to get our community organized as a voting bloc, because that's the piece that we really haven't done. We've gotten some good laws on the books, but we didn't negotiate those laws from a position of strength. We're not perceived as a voting bloc. We haven't demonstrated our political power. And until we do that, I think we're going to continue to have second-class civil rights laws.
Well, thank you. We have, I guess, one more question, and then...
I think it's very frustrating to think that there are only certain conditions that cause us problems when we're disabled. I don't know. It might be the curb cuts today, but it's the restroom tomorrow. It's the motel the next day. It's down the line. Everything is a problem. But when you say we need to get some power, do you think, as awful as it might be, that the wounds that will be returning from this Middle East, whatever it is, it's not a war because we never approved it, there's going to be so many people that are going to need the services that we genetically inherited or however we want to state it. Is our sense of power going to be there, and are we working on that now? The economics of the whole thing will change it for everyone else. The dollars will be spread much thinner, and will those who have the power look at it just as a right of them? I guess I would like some of your input in that.
I'll just say briefly, a lot of the federal initiative in mental health advocacy and services, which eventually led to the President Kennedy's message on mental health in 1963, came out of veterans returning from World War II who had faced psychiatric problems which needed to be addressed. I think that one of the narratives that comes from people coming back from a war having lost limbs and having suffered other kinds of PTSD and other kinds of disabilities is that there's another narrative that plays, which is a very powerful one, which is that people who gave themselves to the country, whether they liked the cause or not, and who suffered because of that, who therefore have a claim on us that may be seen as distinct and more powerful than others. And I think you make a good point, which is if that's left out there just for that group, there will be, I think, a lost opportunity to try to bring to the attention of people more generally that there are lots of people who contribute in lots of ways, and whether you think of it as they're owed it because of how they contribute or it's just the right thing to do, once again, seems to me is something to take advantage of. It's a little hard when, it seems to me, the government does a great deal right now in not bringing to light those people who are returning home in ways of reflecting damage.
I just add two things to that. One, I think one of our challenges that's unique to the folks coming back from this war is that they are going to get hit up very quickly with a stem cell message, you know, that the answer here is let's get more funding into stem cell research or whatever we need to cure whatever your condition is. And I worry that they may miss our opportunity to get them involved in broader issues around civil rights and changing society. Second is these veterans, more so than any veterans before, are coming back with undiagnosed brain injuries because of the weapons systems that are being used. They're not going to get the service-connected veterans benefits because they weren't diagnosed in the field. And our service delivery system is totally unprepared to deal with the long-term issues stemming from their brain injuries. So you're absolutely right. There's an opportunity to work with the veterans coming back, and you're right that historically that's how we've made progress. But I think there are some unique challenges for these veterans that we maybe haven't seen in this way before.
Well, thank you very much, Bob and Andy, for an interesting panel.
That also has a writing service
that you can get these things through.
Yeah. You probably we'll have to see about getting scooched past some folks.
You get two wheelchairs next to each other. Well, one cannot be stationary and the other one can get around it. Just the other.
Let me talk to who
There's
is that?
That's room,
Ray.
Right?
Yeah, no, it's a problem getting by. It's Ray's. I'll see if Ray can scooch his scooter, get Ray's scooter scooched out of the way. We ought to be able to make it happen. Well, that's Ray's scooter in front, at the head of the line.
Oh, with the
and then there's, the brown chair. I think that's, well, no, that's not Ray's. You're right. That's somebody else's. But I'll see if we can get it scooched. Oh. I missed him. The guy that's sitting here in the light brown suit, bald head. I mean, I'm going to guess he's come back after the break. He was sitting right over here. That's Jim Gears.
Oh, okay.
The new guy from RSC.
Where is he?
in mourning again. I thought I would speak so that my text would bring people in and not find the subject. I'll give you about another minute to settle in.
And those will all be available. And the transcripts all going to be available. Were you here last night? Over at the barrister?
All right, hello. You know, the good thing about a conference like this is that there are no competing sessions, and so you are where you are, and we can run on whatever time we really want to, because you won't go anywhere, because we have lunch and it's too cold outside to mill around out there again here in Ohio. We had that one good day. Welcome, good morning. I'm Brenda Brueggemann, and I am from the Department of English, or rather I say the Department of English is my home, although I'm never home anymore. I direct the Disability Studies Minor Program and also the American Sign Language Program here at Ohio State University. And Professor Amy Schumann, down there at the end, in the color at the end, is my co-convener on this panel and also in the Department of English, and she's a folklorist. And she just flew all the way back from, she's on sabbatical, and she's been in Israel, and she flew all the way back just to be here at this conference. So we organize the speakers for this. And the subject of this session is primarily how law mediates between personal and cultural narratives. And we have three speakers on the panel. I'm going to introduce them one by one before they each do their own session. And the first speaker is Professor G. Thomas Kauser, whom I know as Tom Kauser, and he is a professor of English and the director of disability studies at Hofstra University, and I know he was very integral in getting the disability studies program started at his university at Hofstra. Over the course of his career, he's been very productive. He has about 4 books and probably some 50 articles, and 2 of his most recent books are relevant to the subject of disability and narrative. They are Recovering Bodies, Illness, Disability, and Life Writing, which is how I first found out about him. And the most recent one, Vulnerable Subjects, Ethics, and Life Writing. And Tom also chaired or convened or coordinated, whatever verb you want, the MLA conference, Modern Language Association Conference on Disability Studies in the Humanities, which was held at Emory University in March 2004. He's currently working on a study of narratives of filiation, memoirs of fathers, while he's also writing a memoir of his own father. So, Tom.
Thank you very much, Brenda. Am I being heard? Yes, good. Thank you. My title is Undoing Hardships, Life Writing and Disability Law, and I have an epigraph from Matthew Diller. Whether the ADA has the transformative effect that its supporters predicted will ultimately not be resolved in the courtroom. When I first turned my attention to the topic of this conference, I found encouragement in the introduction to Kay Schaefer and Sidney Smith's recent book, Human Rights and Narrated Lives, The Ethics of Recognition. Let me quote a chunk of it here, and you'll see why. These are the very first words of the introduction. The post-Cold War decade of the 1990s has been labeled the decade of human rights. Not incidentally, it has also been described as a decade of life narratives, what commentators refer to as the time of the memoir. Many of these life narratives tell of human rights violations. Victims of abuse around the world have testified to their experience in an outpouring of oral and written narratives. These narratives begin to voice, recognize, and bear witness to a diversity of values, appearances, and ways of imagining a just social world, and responding to injustice, inequality, and human suffering. Indeed, over the last 20 years, life narratives have become one of the most potent vehicles for advancing human rights claims. What could be better for my purposes than this explicit linkage of human rights and memoir, especially that final claim of the indispensability of life narrative in advancing human rights claims? Progressive disability laws, the ADA, its American antecedents, and its international equivalents, are prime examples of contemporary human rights legislation. And as I've argued elsewhere, the current surge in disability memoir is related to these legal initiatives insofar as both life narrative and disability law are aspects of a broad disability rights movement. In this sense, the story of disability rights activism and disability life writing can be subsumed in Schaefer and Smith's master narrative of the simultaneous worldwide emergence and convergence of life narrative and human rights campaigns. But when we try to get beyond such grand generalities, the picture becomes more complex and, I think, more troubling. I hope to show this by exploring a number of distinct ways in which the three elements named in this panel's title inform and shape each other. What I intend to do, then, is to identify and characterize some distinct relations among disability law, personal narrative, and cultural narrative. I hope this will help move us beyond the valid but rather vague notion of mediation. I have no quarrel with the proposition that law mediates between personal and cultural narrative. I think it's true, but I think that it oversimplifies the relation among these three things. That is, it's the truth, but not the whole truth. So help me, Darwin. The first relation I have in mind is an anticipatory relation between personal narrative and disability law. I'm thinking here of the personal testimony that demonstrates the lack of and need for disability rights laws. These narratives are aggrieved and plaintive in an etymological sense, that is, not mournful, but rather complaining of perceived injustice. This set of narratives then anticipates and demands the enactment of disability rights legislation. Such narratives call for laws that will prevent the injustices of which they complain. These narratives are often short, sometimes oral rather than written, and if written, may take utilitarian, that is, non-literary form. A historical analogy with slave narratives is perhaps appropriate. This testimony, like slave narrative, calls for legislation that will make it obsolete as a genre. Although this dimension of the history of the ADA is obscure to me, I presume that such narratives played a large role in the conception, drafting, and enactment of the law. The original impetus for the bill must have been, in part, the communication of individual experiences of discrimination and oppression. This, then, is a proleptic and proactive relation. These narratives precede and seek, in effect, to prescribe disability rights law. Their doing so at once depends on and advances helps to advance a change in the prevailing cultural narratives of disability. That is, legislation barring discrimination against disabled people can only be passed once it is perceived as such by analogy with other more patent forms of discrimination. And this is, after all, what distinguishes the new cultural narratives of disability, that disability is seen, indeed it is defined, as a condition of exclusion and oppression. Once such legislation is passed, the new cultural narrative is, or should be, reinforced, and new personal narratives become possible. To my knowledge, these anticipatory narratives have not been collected and published as prominently as narratives of other forms of human rights abuses. However, I am aware of one volume in this vein, Mary Grimley Mason's Working Against Odds, Stories of Disabled Women's Work Lives, with a foreword by Rosemary Garland Thompson. Mason's book collects and presents stories based on interviews of women facing discrimination in the workplace. One of these stories, that of Adrian, whose last name is withheld, but who is evidently Adrian Ash, illustrates the best-case scenario of the reciprocal relations between personal narrative and disability law. Born blind in 1946, Adrian did not benefit much from disability rights legislation until she was an adult. Interestingly, the workplace was much less receptive to her than the classroom had been, and as she ventured onto the job market as a young adult, her personal narrative, which can be summed up in two words, I can, kept running into a powerful cultural narrative whose gist was, you, that is, blind people, can't. In response, like many people with disabilities, she made her condition, not her visual impairment, but her disablement, her cause. As an advocate for disabled people in the New York State Division of Human Rights in the early 70s, she helped enact the sort of legislation that would enable her and others to have a career and thus a life. So Adrienne Ashe's interior narrative helped inscribe laws that altered the cultural narrative in ways that would in turn allow her to tell her story to Mary Mason as the prominent bioethicist she has become. As I say, that's the best case scenario. The passage of disability rights legislation does not entirely obviate plaintive narratives, of course. To the contrary, violations of civil rights persist. Indeed, one of the DA's effects and presumable intentions is to evoke such narratives. Once such legislation exists, these narratives may become literal grievances, grist for legal cases, their narrators, legal plaintiffs. The relation between personal narrative and law is then changed significantly. To be successful in court, plaintiffs' narratives must be shaped carefully and consciously to the language of the law itself. This is a significant constraint, and as an earlier paper sort of fleshed out this process and talked about the complicated nature of the mediation of those narratives in court. In the process of adjudication, the personal narratives may be confirmed by judgment in their favor, or they may be disconfirmed by judgment against them, deemed to fall outside the purview of the law. It is by now well known and has been amply documented by Ruth Kolker and the ABA itself that the vast majority, upwards of 90% of Title I plaintiffs, lose their cases. Indeed, according to Ruth O'Brien, over 80% of the cases are dismissed by federal judges on summary judgment. One of the curious but perhaps necessary distinguishing characteristics of disability legislation as civil rights law is the requirement that plaintiffs first establish their standing under the law. That is, they must prove that they are members of the protected class. This is not required of victims of discrimination on the basis of race or gender. And a huge majority of cases is dismissed because the plaintiffs are deemed not to have a disability. That is, they're deemed not to belong to the protected class. In cases now notorious among disability rights advocates, plaintiffs have been legally adjudged to be non-disabled under the law, which is to say that not only their narratives, but their claimed identities have been discounted. In cases that proceed to the question of discrimination, personal narratives may be construed in a way that affects the interpretation of the law as precedent for future cases, and thus, in some sense, rewrites the law. This may be particularly true of the ADA, one of whose notable characteristics is the deliberate use of vague terms like reasonable accommodation and undue hardship. Without such ambiguous terms, the bill probably would have faced much stronger opposition. With it, however, the law seems designed, or at least destined, to invite legal challenge. The effect seems to be that the ADA's precise implications have been left to the courts to decide. And as has been well documented by Linda Hamilton Krieger, over the short history of the ADA, the trend of cases heard has been to narrow the scope of the law's protections. And that is in part because of the power and resilience of the prevailing cultural narratives of disability, some of which were spelled out in an earlier paper. The narratives of unsuccessful plaintiffs, then, may inadvertently serve as bookends to the first set of narratives I mentioned. The anticipatory stories suggested the need for a law. They evoked and justified the legislation that was to address and obviate their complaints. The latter set sometimes serves to restrict the law's application, in effect, to amend the law. Thus, while they are submitted as narratives of injustice perpetuated despite the law, they may come to serve as cautionary tales to others seeking their rights under the law. Thus, a kind of double jeopardy exists. The plaintiffs are not the only losers. In Linda Hamilton Krieger's introduction to a volume of essays devoted to the phenomenon of judicial backlash, she points out that, and I quote, "The Act's definition of disability had been drawn broadly to cover not only the traditional disabled, such as individuals who were blind, deaf, or used wheelchairs, but also people who had stigmatizing medical conditions such as diabetes, epilepsy, or morbid obesity. It covered not only people who were actually disabled, but those who had a record of a disability, such as cancer survivors, whom employers might be unwilling to hire for fear of increased medical insurance costs or future incapacity. The statute covered people who were not disabled at all, but were perceived as such, like people with asymptomatic HIV or a genetic predisposition toward a particular illness." Whereas the drafter's intention was to define the protected class in the broadest terms, the tendency of judges has been to circumscribe the class very narrowly, limiting it to individuals who have an impairment that, in the words of the Act itself, substantially limits one or more of the major life activities of such individuals. The justices, then, have preferred to employ the first and most restrictive of the ADA's three qualifying statuses. As a result, in cases heard under Title I employment, there has emerged a pattern described by Matthew Diller in his essay In Backlash. Typically, the ADA defendant argues that the plaintiff's impairments preclude him or her from performing the job at issue, but that the individual is not generally precluded from work or any other major life activity. When fully accepted by a court, this line of argument results in a ruling that the plaintiff is not a person with a disability, despite medical impairments that render him or her supposedly unqualified for the job. The import of these cases is that many people are precluded from performing their past jobs because of their employer's reaction to their medical impairments that are not viewed as having disabilities under the meaning of the ADA. Such results have created the familiar Title I catch-22. Many plaintiffs are deemed too impaired to do their jobs, but not sufficiently disabled to be protected by the ADA. Diller goes on to point out that this restrictive interpretation has a number of perverse effects. For example, the likelihood that an individual plaintiff will be deemed disabled within the meaning of the ADA is directly inverse to the chances that he or she would actually be able to win on the merits. But the crux of the issue, it seems to me, is that the distinction at the very heart of disability studies, that between impairment and disability, has been lost on jurists. Indeed, one could question Krieger's use of the qualifier actually in the passage I quoted earlier. One could argue that according to the ADA, people with a record of or perceived as having a qualifying impairment are actually disabled. That is, they are disabled literally by definition. That's what the law says. When I write or give talks about disability life narrative as a significant emerging subgenre of the last 20 years, I am wont to recite a long and ever-expanding list of conditions from aphasia and Alzheimer's to stroke and Tourette syndrome that have been the subject of recent disability memoirs, often more than one. That is, some of these conditions have generated their own substantial bodies of literature. I was struck then to come across this passage in Diller's essay. Courts have found that individuals with breast cancer, multiple sclerosis, and stroke did not have disabilities. Courts have also found individuals with lymphoma, brain tumors, heart disease, diabetes, hemophilia, epilepsy, ulcerative colitis, carpal tunnel syndrome, incontinence, depression, bipolar disorder, and paranoia excluded from the definition of disability. SCOTUS, we have a problem. And the problem is not just definitional. Although the ADA language about who qualifies as disabled may be somewhat unfortunate. Rather, the problem lies with the prevailing cultural narrative according to which disability is assumed to be an individual problem, to which the traditional governmental solution has been subsidy or entitlement. That narrative is, after all, inscribed in a whole set of disability laws that seek to determine who shall qualify for public assistance on the basis that their impairments render them incapable of working. The third kind of relation between disability narrative and law is found in personal narratives that recount lives significantly affected or changed by disability laws, such as the ADA. These narratives may lack the hard edge of testimony. They are more likely to be literary in manner and to take the form of memoir. They have a looser relation to the law than those sketched above. Such narratives may not even mention the legislation that has subtly changed the lives they recount. The thrust of my recent work on life writing has been to suggest that one of the most significant developments in late 20th century life writing has been the emergence of what I call the somebody memoir. That is, the memoir that does not take for granted that to be is to be embodied, but rather emphasizes what it is to be, what it is to have or to be a particular kind of body. Not all, but a great deal of this life writing is disability memoir, and much of this in some way or other reflects the effect of disability legislation. Narratives by those in my generation, like Simi Linton's new memoir, My Body Politic, tend to recount lives changed in mid-course by the passage of disability laws in the 70s and later. Narratives by younger authors may recount lives changed from the beginning, or rather shaped from the beginning, by the way such laws have expanded rights and access. And increasingly, such narratives may take such legislation for granted. The least direct, but not the least important way in which personal narrative is shaped by legislation may be just the sense in which stories of being or becoming disabled reflect the sense of disability that is inscribed in current disability law, such that the condition referred to is a social construct rather than a physical condition. Thus, such narratives will increasingly have a retrospective relation to disability law. They will be stories by beneficiaries of the law rather than plaintiffs. This we might characterize as an existential relation to the legislation. The lives and the identities of these life writers have been defined and made possible in part by disability law. Here, disability law may generate new sorts of personal narratives even when the narrators are not fully aware of it. Cultural narrative is not monolithic, and I think it is currently in flux. But personal narrative is not necessarily progressive either. And the standard scripts of disability memoir until recently have often been fairly regressive. As I have shown elsewhere, a number of rhetorics still common in disability memoir, for example, the rhetoric of triumph, of horror, of spiritual compensation, and of nostalgia for lost abilities in the case of acquired disability, are in fact inimical to the best interests of persons with disabilities. We need, then, not just more disability narratives, but more progressive disability narratives, narratives whose authors claim disability in the new sense. Try to offer an overview of ways in which personal and cultural narrative and law may interact. And as I've suggested, there's no single mode of mediation, no single direction in which influence flows among these three phenomena under discussion. The law can never be very far ahead of cultural narrative. As Diller suggests, the narrowing of the ADA may be seen as a function of its being too far ahead of cultural narrative. Personal narrative has more leeway, and I tend to favor those in the vanguard for obvious reasons. But published narratives, like the law, cannot be too far ahead of cultural narrative either, and for some of the same reasons. They have to be mediated through the process of publication and editing. Personal narrative can push the envelope, but to mix the metaphor, it alone cannot deliver the message. As a scholar from literary studies speaking at a conference sponsored by a law school, I fear I may have merely reinvented the wheel. But I hope I may have opened up a bit the complex and multifarious relations among personal narrative, cultural narrative, and disability law. And I want to insist that this nexus is an important one. Toward the conclusion of his essay in Backlash, Matthew Diller reminds us that judges, and I'm quoting, judges construing and applying statutes are inevitably affected by the broader social and political environment, even as they disclaim any such influence. Only broad-based social understanding of and support for the principles undergirding the ADA will make the statute's promise a reality. Although enactment of the law and efforts to enforce it can play an important role in helping to create such understanding and support, neither ringing statutory language nor seemingly tough provisions for judicial enforcement are sufficient to carry the day. As the new Supreme Court takes shape, two things give me some hope for the long run. The first is that thanks to the emergence and spread of disability studies in American higher education, the next generation of jurists may come to the bench with a greater degree of disability literacy than the current one. The other is that the proliferation of disability narrative may help to expand the general public's sense of what counts as disability. Both factors will be important if the hard-won rights of disabled people are to be preserved. Thanks.
Out of the way. Our second speaker is Mark Willis, and there are at least three versions of Mark Willis, and or maybe I should use the metaphor strands here. There are three strands to Mark Willis, and lucky you, you're going to get to see all three of those strands, experience them all come together right here on this stage today. Strand one of the Mark Willis I know is that he's a research administrator at the Boonshoff School of Medicine at Wright State University over in Dayton, Ohio. And he's been there since 1984. And during that time, he has worked as a medical and a science writer, as a public affairs officer, and as a web developer. That's one strand. Strand two is Mark Willis is a writer. His professional writing career spans 35 years, and it includes work as a newspaper reporter, an editor, and a media consultant. His creative nonfiction work has twice been honored by an artist fellowship from the Ohio Arts Council, both in 2000 and 2004. And he's been working with those artist fellowships on a project called Improvising on the Genome, which explores his own family's multi-general experience with disability and hereditary disease. Strand three, Mark Willis is a committed disability rights advocate, and he's been doing that now for more than 30 years. He was a member of the board of directors and public affairs director of the American Council for the Blind for 5 years in the mid-80s. He organized Agenda 88, which was a statewide public information campaign during the 1988 election, which produced Ohio's first voter's registration guide for people with disabilities. And he worked as a legislative advocate for passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act and was recognized for that in 1990 by an invitation from the White House to attend the signing of the ADA. His current scholarly interests include the protection of human subjects and research, the social history of eugenics and genetics, and citizen journalism in the emerging Web 2.0 media environment. He's always doing a lot of interesting things. And every time I get a chance in the 8 years I've now known him, I find a reason, an excuse to bring Mark over from Dayton. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda. I've never thought of all of these various projects in terms of strands, and suddenly I had the fear that I might begin to disassociate right here on the spot. I call my talk Blowback. Three generations of imbeciles are not enough. And I will begin by unpacking the title to try to give you an idea of where I hope to go or hope to get in the next 20 minutes or so. Blowback is a euphemism created by the Central Intelligence Agency to refer to the unintended and unexpected events, geopolitical events, in which the CIA had a hand. And I'm sure that they wanted to keep this as technical jargon for use only inside the company, but the word blew back on them in a self-fulfilling prophecy. It gained traction in the year 2000 in the foreign policy community when the Asia specialist Chalmers Johnson made it the title of a book on American empire. And since the events of September 11, 2001, blowback has become a pop culture buzzword for many kinds of events which no longer seem to be under our control. The concept should be obvious, and you can think of it in terms of policy wonks reverse engineering the golden rule. Chalmers Johnson suggested that it was as simple as the proverb, reap what you sow. It sounds like one of Newton's laws of physics. For every action, there is an opposite and equal reaction. But it cannot be fitted into that neat an equation. We don't perceive much Newtonian order in the world anymore. We find asymmetrical power relationships everywhere we look. And even our military, after spending trillions of dollars on high-tech weapons acquisition, now needs to retool for asymmetrical warfare. I want to apply the idea of blowback to language and how even single words and apparently simple utterances can acquire narrative power. Narrative power that provokes, almost demands, a response, asymmetrical or otherwise. So in other words, I want to try to get at how narrative begets narrative. And I'm going to get theoretical in this, but I'm not interested in talking about narrative only in theoretical terms. So I will also try to tell you something of a story of my own experience with blowback. The second element of my title, I can tell from the laughter, is familiar to this audience. It is my rebuttal of the most notorious sentence in Buck versus Bell, the landmark Supreme Court decision from 1927, which upheld the police powers of the states to compel the sterilization of mentally incompetent people confined in state institutions. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, the great dissenter, wrote for the majority in this case. Biographers and historians, some of them, tend to write off that sentence as the punch of an acerbic old man who had earned the right to speak bluntly. And others, who are embarrassed by that sentence, ignore it altogether as an anomaly in Justice Holmes's jurisprudence. To my ear, that sentence is a narrative in and of itself, and yet it is a narrative that cannot be isolated from the other kinds of narratives that we have heard speakers discuss this morning. To my ear, it is a narrative that demands a response. And I know some of you in this room have formulated your own responses to it over time. Buck versus Bell decision is about 1,000 words long, and it is rich in language and ideology that deserves to be unpacked and interpreted at greater length than I can give it in the scope of this talk. But let me say briefly, when Justice Holmes stated, quote, "Experience has shown that heredity plays an important role in insanity, imbecility, and etc." He was affirming a central idea of the American eugenics movement. Then and now, that idea is based on dubious science. When Justice Holmes observed that the public welfare sometimes calls upon the best citizens to sacrifice their lives, he may have been thinking of his own patriotic service in the Civil War, but he also was giving voice to the thinly disguised class prejudice that fueled the American eugenics movement. And when he equated, quote, "the cutting of the fallopian tubes" with the public health mandate for compulsory vaccinations, I think he was revealing something about his own sexual politics that he himself never understood in such rational terms. But I'm going to focus on the one sentence, the sentence we know, the sentence that embarrasses us or sometimes makes us laugh and at other times makes us want to fight. And I want to understand the mechanism of how a sentence and a particular word in that sentence can make that happen. I want to understand why I react, why I feel that I have to respond, why I feel like I have a personal relationship with the words of Oliver Wendell Holmes. I am a child of the 1960s, and I guess that makes me another old hippie now. As I began to pay attention to the events in the world around me, particularly the civil rights and the anti-war protests, I found an appealing role model in Oliver Wendell Holmes. And when I talk about this, I know I risk slipping into what Tom just referred to as the nostalgia for lost abilities. Earlier this morning, I heard him call it the rhetoric of nostalgia, and it's like, ha, it made me strike me dead for that. But when I was a child, before I began to lose eyesight, there was no limit to my reading. And I read everything and anything that my curiosity led me to. And so I read a biography of Justice Holmes from the 1940s called Yankee from Olympus. And as the title suggests, it cast the justice in the mold of an American hero. And then I think I came to Justice Holmes's ideas about freedom of speech by way of Justice William Brennan and the Sullivan versus New York Times decision. And that's not a bad place to start. And then after that, I found my big brother's college textbook on constitutional law, and I read the great dissenting opinions that eventually became the basis for majority opinions on freedom of speech in the 1960s and 70s. I particularly was affected by Justice Holmes's dissent in the 1919 decision, Abrams versus the United States, in which he argued that the state should not ban speech for fear of its consequences, should not ban seditious speech. In that decision, he says something to the effect that the best test of truth is its ability, the ability of a thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market. He also said something I found extraordinary. He said, our Constitution is an experiment, as all life is an experiment. And in essence, the best we can do is make the decisions we have to make based on the information that we have, imperfect or otherwise. When I read that, it gave me goosebumps, and it still does. And I took what he said about ideas and the competition of the market, and I internalized that into a personal credo, which became a foundation of my own personal narrative, as people have described it here today. And my version of it is, speech, no matter how extreme or how objectionable, must be trusted to the marketplace of free ideas. Yankee from Olympus and my brother's constitutional law text never mentioned Buck versus Bell. I didn't hear about that case until early adulthood, after I had embraced my political identity as a person with a disability. I could never have imagined as a child that I would hear the sentence, three generations of imbeciles are enough. But I would hear that sentence and I would feel betrayed. How is it that words can have that kind of effect? How is it that a sentence, which might be a narrative, how is it that it can have that effect? At this point, I'd like to turn this talk to several ideas about language that may help to illuminate that mechanism of response. These ideas come from a Russian philosopher of language named Mikhail Bakhtin. I don't know whether American constitutional law has ever been discussed in light of the theories of Mikhail Bakhtin. And I don't think his work has ever been explored at any depth in the field of disability studies. So I may be going out on a limb here, but I'm going to do it anyway, because Bakhtin has been as influential on my ideas about language in later life as Justice Holmes's ideas about freedom of speech were in the early days. At about the same time Justice Holmes was writing the decision in Buck versus Bell, Bakhtin was writing a book called Marxism and the Philosophy of Language. The book may have been too Marxist and insufficiently Stalinist for its times. Like all of his writing, it is a densely difficult text that must have perplexed the Soviet censors. He chose to publish it not under his own name, but under the name of his friend, V.N. Volosyanov. And if you look for it today, that's how you'll find it, as a book by Volosyanov. None of this protective coloring prevented Bakhtin's arrest and internal exile during Stalin's Great Terror in the 1930s. His writing remained proscribed and marginalized throughout most of his life, and he made his living by teaching English in a parochial or provincial state university out in the sticks. But it began to be published widely in Russian and English in the 1970s. And Bakhtin is perhaps best known in the West among folklorists and critics of post-colonial literature for a book he wrote about Francois Rabelais. In it, he elaborated a theory of carnival, which held that it was the ritual interplay of contending social pressures in a highly stratified society. In Marxism and the Philosophy of Language, Bakhtin insists that language is social and language is material, and that is the most solidly Marxist aspect of his thought. That means that language cannot be isolated from the concrete social and historical contexts in which it is used. In Bakhtin's mind, there would be no ideal of the word imbecile out there in the heavens with Plato's ideal table. No such thing. Its meaning can only be determined through its use in concrete social circumstances. Octin also picked a fight with the prevailing linguistic theory of the time by insisting that the fundamental unit of linguistic analysis was not a syllable, was not a tiny bit of sound or semantic meaning. It was the utterance. And by that, he meant a chunk of language of indeterminate size expressed by one speaker with the expectation or likelihood of a response by another person. An utterance can be as simple as a one-word command or expletive, such as no or yes. And an utterance can be as large and complex and fully deployed as a novel such as War and Peace. Bakhtin, what is interesting about the utterance as a unit for study by linguists is the interactive social process that surrounds the utterance. He called that process dialogic, and the idea is sometimes called dialogism. And so you can begin to see how an utterance such as three generations of imbeciles are enough. It's out there in the world and produces a response. It is an utterance because it produces a response, because people want to respond to it or feel that they must. The word imbecile in that utterance is an utterance in and of itself. And another passage in Marxism and the Philosophy of Language, which Bakhtin's biographers say is the E equals MC squared of his theories, explains that, explains how that works. And in it he says, a word is a two-sided act. Its meaning is determined equally by whose word it is and for whom it is meant. A word is a shared territory between between speaker and interlocutor. So a word is a two-sided act, and a word is a shared territory. Clearly, the word imbecile is such a territory where people have fought over what it means. It could be, it's likely that Justice Holmes meant to use the word in a strictly scientific sense. Strange as it sounds to us today, imbecile was a specific diagnostic category then, posited between idiot and moron, low grade and high grade. In the intelligence hierarchy measured by the Stanford-Binet IQ test. But imbecile also had and has had a rich history of usage as a pejorative term, as slang, and that usage goes back at least as far as the 17th century. And there's no way that Justice Holmes was not aware of that as well. When the word imbecile first crossed my conceptual horizon, which is the language Bakhtin uses to explain such things, it came in a Three Stooges cartoon when they poked each other's eyes and went, imbecile? So the first time I heard the utterance in the Buck versus Bell decision, I thought of Larry, Curly, and Moe. It's my gut feeling that Justice Holmes knew he was using a double entendre when he wrote that sentence. I believe he wanted his imbeciles both ways. And he probably believed that the sentence was so self-evident and conclusive that it would be the final word on compulsory sterilization. It was not. It reverberated dialogically. It continues to reverberate today. And Justice Holmes probably was not aware. I mean, he probably knew he was getting away with something when he wrote that sentence, but he probably did not understand at the level of the mechanics of language. But he was also planting the seed that would destabilize his own meaning and intent, that would destabilize his utterance. And that brings me to one final idea from Bakhtin, which he elaborated in an essay called Discourse and the Novel. And that idea is that just as a single word is the dynamic tension between conflicting meanings, speaker and interlocutor, language itself is a continual flux between centripetal and centrifugal forces. Centripetal forces impose order on language from above. Think of sacred texts, legal codices, dictionaries, prescriptive grammar. Centrifugal forces undermine that order from below. Think of jokes and slang, popular ballads, and folklore. In this way, language continually is creating and expanding, and it's this flow of forces back and forth between the centripetal that push down and the centrifugal that want to blow it up. This idea of centripetal and centrifugal forces has been very influential in the study of post-colonial literature. And when you remember that the institution where Carrie Buck was sterilized after the Supreme Court decision was called the State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, it is not a stretch to understand the Buck versus Bell decision as the exercise of colonial power. It certainly was a centripetal force of great magnitude, but I believe it pushed too far, and it pushed too hard, particularly through the word imbecile. And so it could not prevent its own blowback, and it has had unintended consequences then and now that continue. Again, it is beyond the scope of this talk for me to elaborate at any detail about the historical consequences of the Buck versus Bell decision. But let me say again briefly that Buck versus Bell became the sterilization laws upheld by Buck versus Bell became the model for similar legislation enacted in Nazi Germany. And when the Nazi crimes against humanity were prosecuted at Nuremberg, the survivors of Nazi sterilization could not seek reparations in that court because compulsory sterilization was the law of the land in the United States at that time. Many people believe that the American eugenics movement was eclipsed by the Nazi experience and that it went away after World War II. Certainly, American eugenics before World War II never achieved anything like the Nazis' industrial efficiency or scale of human destruction. But I am not convinced that the attitudes and even the policies represented by the American eugenics movement really went away. And it is my belief that the legacy of Buck versus Bell continues to haunt the future. And that's a phrase that Chalmers Johnson used in his definition of blowback. I believe the blowback continues with respect to that case. Before I close, I need to acknowledge something for the record. The lawyers among you may be wondering just what is my standing in the case of Buck versus Bell? And like many of us in this room, I have been called an imbecile more than once in my life, but it has never been applied to me as a diagnostic category. However, I was diagnosed with a genetic eye disease 35 years ago. My sister has the same genetic disease. And I have written elsewhere about my own personal experiences with being recruited for genetic research studies related to that disease. In the heyday of American eugenics, my sister and I could have been labeled hereditary defectives. And so when I hear words like that, like imbecile or moral imbecile or degenerate, these words from the past that many people say are simply the quaint usage of the past, gives me pause. When I think of that "and et cetera" at the heart of the Buck versus Bell decision, heredity plays an important role in insanity, imbecility, and et cetera, it gives me pause. I believe the ambiguity of that "and et cetera" is broader and more dangerous today than ever before. And when I hear such things as our sentence about the three generations, it stirs up in me a dialogic response that summons my deepest sense of otherness in the world. And that sense of otherness has really become the motivator for me as a writer. And so that too, I guess, is a kind of blowback. It is certainly a dialogic response that Justice Holmes could never have anticipated. So in conclusion, let me say, I still do admire Justice Holmes with certain qualifications. And I still do believe in this personal credo about trusting the marketplace of free ideas. I also believe that that marketplace will never be as free or as complete as we imagine unless it includes the stories and experiences of people across the vast continuum of ability and disability. And to those of you here who acknowledge the identity person with a disability, let me say to you, if we do not continue to tell our own narratives, we will have to live with the narratives that others tell about us. Thank you.
Hello. Our third speaker is Sue Swike, who comes to us from Berkeley. And at Berkeley, she has served as the presidential chair in undergraduate education, where she was an integral force in the development of the disability studies program at Berkeley. And she's coordinator now of the Ed Roberts, co-coordinator of the Ed Roberts Fellowship in Disability Studies, which is a postdoctoral program there that some of you are probably familiar with. She has taught or co-taught a number of undergraduate and graduate courses on disability that's just endlessly fascinating, such things as disability and literature, discourses of disability, the disability rights movement, race, ethnicity, and disability, and most recently, psychiatric disability and disability studies. Aside from those things, she also has teaching and research interest in 20th century poetry, women's studies and gender theory, and war literature and children's literature. But she's here today primarily because she's completing a book about the American Ugly Laws. And this book is a study of the social and cultural history of an ordinance adopted by many American cities in the late 19th and early 20th century. And these laws prohibited diseased, maimed, and deformed people, as they were titled, imbeciles probably too, from exposing themselves to public view. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Brenda. Can you hear me okay? I got the opportunity to prove to you today that three generations of panelists are enough. I'm a late addition to this panel, and I'm very grateful to Mark and Tom for giving up some of their time today. And I want to, on a very different register, dedicate this talk to the playwright John Belluso, who died this week, and whose work I'm going to talk about a little. I want to talk today very quickly about a few court cases in which disabled people demanded rereading of the legal framing of their bodies and what I'm going to call their voices in one particular context, which is American begging law. And I want to make two provisos, disclaimers at the outset. One is, I'm an English professor, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a historian, and so I am so especially eager for advice from people who occupy either of those categories at this conference, as well as from everyone else. And the second one is, I just have to say it, I don't in any way mean to idealize begging, or of course to reduce the history of American disability to the history of begging. I don't know how many of you follow the really raging debate this past year on the Society for Disability Studies listserv when Kathy Kudlick ironically proposed as a fundraiser she was going to sell pencil. I think it was pencil. It might have been a tin cup. Anyway, I think it was selling pencils, something with a hint of begging to it. And if you follow that debate, you understand the degree of stress that can ensue when disability and beg are uttered in the same breath. So, nonetheless, many disabled people in American history begged, and many beg. And stories about disabled beggars, the fakers, as well as the four real ones, the ones who are abject and the ones who are insolent, all those stories circulate as a certain kind of urban legend in U.S. culture. And what I mean by that is they are legends about disability in the city, in the modern city. And they're legends with powerful effects in the courtroom. So as Brenda told you, I'm finishing a book called The American Ugly Laws, and she described what that law said. This particular municipal ordinance had banned disease, maimed, deformed, disfigured, so as to be unsightly and disgusting objects. People, that's a very ungrammatical sentence. Anyway, that ordinance has come to function as a kind of literal urban legend in disability studies. It's usually cited, usually without footnotes, most often as a City of Chicago ordinance with a date of 1911. But the first appearance of that ordinance that I found was in San Francisco in 1867. And many cities across the country over a span of 50 years put it into their code books. And it wasn't only a municipal ordinance. At least one state had this law, the state of Pennsylvania. Often called the Ugly Law, the law is more accurately labeled the Unsightly Beggar Ordinance, for it emerged always, and it was usually applied in the context of crackdowns on mendicancy. My aim in the book is to transform popular understandings of the so-called ugly laws by demonstrating their economic foundation in anti-begging laws that were inflected by categories of gender, ethnicity, and race. I'm still going to call my subject the ugly law in this talk, partly because the law was ugly, partly just it's a very provocative and resonant term, and partly to honor the coining of the phrase by Robert and Marcia Pierce Bergdorf, who uncovered the ordinance in a landmark treatise on disability law in 1974. A municipal librarian in Chicago insists that the ugly law is actually an urban legend. My purpose in the book has been to rewrite this urban legend about disability into a researched argument about law, politics, and cultural aesthetics in a carefully specified and articulated range of historical, national, and discursive sites. The law did exist. It existed in multiple registers. What does not exist, as far as I know, is a single trace of a legal challenge to this law. There were, though, legal challenges by disabled people to the begging stories told about them, and that's what I want to concentrate on here today. Take, for instance, the 1911 effort by George Gray, the legless newsboy of Times Square, who sued influential reformist James Forbes after Forbes boasted in print that his charitable work had induced Gray to lead an honest life and had converted him from a crippled beggar to a self-respecting peddler. Forbes had recognized Gray in print as the very type that needed charitable intervention, and this is a quotation from the essay by Forbes. "The runaway boy who goes on the road to see the world lost both legs while a tramp, returned to New York, and became a street beggar." Gray had no desire to be Forbes's poster newsboy. He sought unsuccessfully to tell his own story and tell it differently. He objected to the insinuation that he had ever lacked a reputation for honesty and integrity. He refused, in short, to be made for one moment into an unsightly beggar. His libel case against Forbes was fought through multiple appeals. In the end, he lost, required to pay $10 in costs for his trouble. Gray's difficulty contesting Forbes' interpolations was compounded by the New York Times coverage of the case, which erroneously reported his name not as George, but as James, Forbes' own first name. Let's turn from the subject of libel to consider the place of disability legends in the history of legal appeals directly involving begging law. An Ohio judge in 1921, who was upholding the conviction of a blind man for begging, said this: "It is obvious that if such an ordinance included the blind only, its unconstitutionality would not be questioned." It's clear it would be seen as unconstitutional if it only applied to the blind. This judge would presumably have had no doubt, therefore, about the illegality of the ugly law. And yet no one, not him, not anyone, not in his own town, which had enacted and was still enforcing the ordinance, or anywhere else, no one I know of sought grounds of any kind to challenge the constitutionality of the unsightly beggar ordinances. Arguably, Pennsylvania's state version of an ugly law violated the 14th Amendment, depriving disabled citizens of liberty and abridging their privileges and immunities, but if so, no one noticed. Partly because, to a significant extent, the notion of the citizen presumed an able body, partly because the culture understood disability as the literal opposite of liberty, privilege, and immunity, and probably primarily because the measure was generally regarded as protective and benevolent, no analytic framework placing ugly law in the light of the U.S. Constitution ever emerged. Disabled people did occasionally manage to take procedural objections to their arrest for begging to appeals courts. And I don't have time here to talk about it, but there's a really fascinating series of cases in Pennsylvania, which was a kind of epicenter for conflicts around disability and begging, that involved a series of blind men who were institutionalized in a home for blind men, only blind men, that had a broom-making workshop, who would leave the home and go out on the streets, and usually in Philadelphia, and be arrested for begging, and then one by one attempted to bring procedural objections to those arrests. And I don't have any proof of it, but it seems pretty clear to me that they knew each other and that this was a kind of organized effort. And it went very badly for them. They usually got sentences like 6 months of hard labor for begging. But I want to focus for the remainder of my time just on one specific issue, and framed by these questions. Can the unsightly beggar speak, and does he or she have permission to speak freely? What I want to look at is the history of cases in which American courts have mulled over the question of whether municipal bans on begging constitute a violation of the First Amendment. The argument that panhandling is protected free speech, that's very often been made about vocal soliciting and about peddling, and not so often applied to cases that involve wordless gestures of begging, and certainly never extended explicitly into the terrain of ugly law. The emphasis in the unsightly beggar ordinances on appearances rather than words made appeals to overturn the law on First Amendment grounds highly unlikely. Disabled bodies spoke volumes, spoke, if anything, too loudly on the streets of cities that cracked down on disabled beggars, but they never, in fact, spoke freely, and they were never imagined to speak politically. Occasionally, we find the presence of disabled bodies in legal challenges to begging prohibitions, but these bodies inevitably function only as exceptions to, not as grounds of, First Amendment claims. They frame the larger questions at stake, but the questions are never theirs. They appear, but not on their own behalf. Take, for example, the ruling in CCB versus Florida, an important 1984 decision holding that cities are not entitled to absolutely prohibit a beggar's exercise of his freedom of speech. The court in CCB bolstered its case by noting that even in a prior court decision upholding the constitutionality of an anti-begging statute, and this is a quotation, the blind or crippled person who merely sits or stands by the wayside is excepted from the ambit of the law. Here, the right of the blind or crippled person to beg is defended not as speech, but as the outside of speech, mute and passive, mere. And disabled bodies do speak up in the history of American begging law. Anything they say can be used against them. This is illustrated in an 1877 case, which is very much part of the culture of the unsightly beggar ordinances as they were developing. This case, it was a New York appeals court. And in this case, the court ruled that disabled bodies in and of themselves could constitute a form of speech, begging speech, and that the exercise of this kind of speech was punishable. This wasn't a First Amendment case, so that the constitutionality of begging law wasn't being challenged here. In the matter of Haller, which is an 1877 case, we find the narrative of Frank Haller, and I'm going to read you a passage from this case. Frank Haller, a boy about 10 years of age and a cripple, unable to stand and obliged to move on his hands and legs. At the time of his arrest, he had been moving down Broadway on the sidewalk from John Street to Wall Street when he was stopped and taken into custody by the officers. As he passed along the sidewalk, the officer saw him holding out his hand to several persons and receiving money from them, but he did not hear him speak to any of them. It is claimed that this silent action on his part was not begging alms within the meaning of the statutes. The court rejected this claim, affirming that the anti-mendicancy statute in question, quote, does not necessarily require proof of spoken words to constitute begging. In fact, the judges argued, in many instances, words are far less effective to accomplish the end than simple acts. The deaf and dumb man, real or pretended, who stands with a placard on his breast and with extended hat or hand, is a solicitor of charity as completely as though he spoke to passers-by. So gesture could constitute begging, and the theoretical deaf man comes forward to illustrate that. But the ruling went further still. At the furthest reach of the matter of Haller, the law prohibited not only street behavior, but potentially street being for disabled people. Another quotation. Everyone whose diseased or crippled condition appeals to sympathy, or who places himself in a position to attract attention, or passes along the street calling attention by sign, act, or look to his unhappy condition, is a solicitor of charity within the meaning of the law. Indeed, the class of silent beggars who exhibit deformities, wounds, or injuries, which tell plainer than words their needy and helpless condition, are the most successful solicitors for charity. The language of exhibiting deformity brings us to the brink of the ugly law, and here, as in the unsightly beggar ordinances, acts and performances of appeal seem to be the real problem. There are phrases like placing himself in a position, attracting attention, calling attention, seeking obviously. And the Haller ruling begins with act, talk. The opening is a line that just fascinates me. The act of a cripple is begging for alms. And it's referring to a specific, this is a summary of an appeal. It's referring to Frank Haller, but nonetheless, the language sounds generic. The act of a cripple is begging for alms. So emphasis on act. At the same time, however, because disease or crippling might inevitably, and without any deliberate invitation, draw the stares of passers-by, or because they might engender unsolicited sympathy simply by being seen as unhappy, needy, and helpless conditions, Haller verges on ruling that disabled people, no matter how they behave, are begging embodied. This decision suggests one of the many factors in the emergence of unsightly beggar ordinances, the need to close the loophole which might allow disabled bodies to tell stories of poverty plainer than words. Thus, the one example in the history of pertinent U.S. begging case law, Haller, that treats diseased or crippled conditions as acts of expression, reads them as barred speech, not free speech. At the dramatic and completely made-up climax of John Beluso's biographical play, The Body of Bourne, disabled writer Randolph Bourne openly challenges Chicago's ugly law. From the outset of Beluso's play, Bourne is grappled with his relation to the categories, deformed, for instance, policed by the unsightly beggar ordinances. The play follows Randolph Bourne through the development of his career as an intellectual and social critic, repeatedly stressing Bourne's fear of appearing on stage in public. In Beluso's version of his life, Bourne is finally persuaded to deliver a public speech in Chicago opposing U.S. involvement in World War I. He brushes off police threats to arrest him for delivering the speech, saying, "I'm just a harmless cripple," and he's answered, "That's the point, exactly." The ugly ordinance, he is told, will be used to prevent him from speaking. In a critical scene, Veloso's Bourne flouts the law and appears in spotlight at the Chicago City Club, comparing the war to a disease and insisting, "I will allow my body to be seen." With one notable exception, the arrest of Gott Dewey, a prominent lawyer in Philadelphia, an arrest that provoked the most powerful example of cultural resistance I've found to the ugly laws, but that's another story. With that one exception of the arrest of Gott Dewey, I found no other record of other privileged disabled people legally prohibited from appearing in public for being unsightly or disgusting objects. Unsightliness was a status offense. It was illegal only for people without means. But many poor people, like 10-year-old Frank Haller, went public daily, insisting, like Beluso's Bourne, "I will allow my body to be seen." The display of disability while begging was, or was sometimes, or could be, not only a direct means of subsistence, but also a circumspect and informal means of political struggle. As historian Brad Byram puts it, the public presence of cripples, along with the graphic and brazen act of displaying, encouraged change in social policy and cultural beliefs, particularly after 1890, as the number of beggars reached a new critical mass. But the courts did not recognize this. So I'll end with a question for you, the lawyers especially, I'd love to hear from. Where do you find contemporary equivalents of these legal refusals to read the acts of cripples, or as we now might say, of qualified disabled individuals, as forms of expression, protected and political? The history of begging is part of the history of the infrapolitics of disability. Oliver Wendell Holmes argued that the state could not ban seditious speech for fear of its consequences. If he had understood disability itself as a kind of a form of speech, seditious speech, could he have framed the decision of Buck versus Bell? How are the infrapolitics of disability and speech, or disability as speech, playing out even as we speak today?
We have time for questions. In the back?
I have about 10 minutes.
While we're waiting for the batteries, if you raise your hands at any point, I'll keep a running list of people and then acknowledge you as okay. So I see here and then there.
Okay, we're working now. You asked a question about what's the current description of begging for people with disabilities, and I think if you look at the lack of success in ADA lawsuits. We look at, because people with disabilities are viewed individually as opposed to collectively, each of those individuals appears to be begging for accommodation. And so that may be the beggar of today.
Thank you. That seems exactly right to me. And seen as individually asking for assistance rather than behaving politically.
Yeah. Did the comment for Mark's presentation there is an institution for the mentally retarded in Columbus called the Columbus Institute for MR. And I worked there back in the 80s. And I went back in the archives, and that was engraved in the stone, the Institute for the Imbecile Idiot and Moron. So back in the 20s, they did utilize that phrase to identify institutions for mentally impaired.
Were you making a comment, or were you asking a question? A comment.
Right. Rich narratives could be written simply tracing the names of institutions and how they have changed over time. And it would look like something like the histories of words in the Oxford English Dictionary, and you could correlate it to all kinds of historical material. Perhaps what's significant is that, you know, today we maybe they hire the same consultants that invent the names for new housing developments, the streets and so forth. But you know, we have names like Twin Valley or Oak Ridge or Cherry Crest or something, you know, that is its own kind of turning away from what the institution really is by the innocuousness of its name.
I'm glad Mark made the comment about the use of the term colony, because I think that in my experience of disability studies, that the whole theoretical approach of post-colonialism has gone underemployed. And I was reminded of this by a book review recently in the New York Times. There's a new book called The Colony, which is about a leper colony on Hawaii. And the reviewer made the point, and I think this is interesting, that in terms of how disability history gets written, because when the lives of disabled people are most archived, in theory, it's when they're institutionalized. You know, then you have the discrete minority, the discrete and insular minority. But she made the point that most of the archives, if you go into the archives, and this is what happens in the book, I guess, you learn mostly about the people running the place. You don't really learn so much about the people confined to it. So there are huge challenges there. But I think a post-colonial approach has a lot to offer that hasn't yet been exploited.
Here in the back, and then I see two more hands.
Hi, I'm Jerome Shapiro. I guess this is a comment with, you know, potential responses from the panelists, but listening to all three of you, it occurred to me there's a tremendous crossover area with post-Indian literature and scholarship. And I'm thinking about Gerald Visner's work, who recently retired from Berkeley. And he has looked at the law extensively, both in his scholarly work and in his fiction. His fiction's just wild. I see a nodding head from Berkeley. Do you know Gerald?
Actually, I wrote a section in my book on that riffed off him on his use of the word survivance, right, which I think is an incredibly rich word for disability studies.
Indeed, survivance, yeah, and he uses that in titles and throughout. But one of the questions he raises is the difficulty of proving land rights when you don't have a concept of ownership in a legal system that demands you prove ownership. And so he, both in his fiction and in his scholarly work, he talks about the struggle of going to a court system that says, show me the papers, when you have no sense of, but I don't own the land, I just live on it. Mm-hmm. And this is reverberated in other places, nomadic tribes in Israel that do participate in the mandatory draft army service, come back and find their lands expropriated by the state, and the state says, okay, if we made a mistake, show us proof of ownership. And they're going, but we're nomads. We don't own the land. We just live on it. So this, you know, has been talked about by several of the panelists of how the law shapes the discourse. And in other areas, this has tremendous impact as well, particularly, I'd say, post-Indian scholarship and what's called post-Indian literature. So if there's any comments or responses to that. Also, I believe Gerald Visner does refer to Bakim in some of his work. He's more into contemporary critical theory, but I believe he does mention Bakim. I'm not sure. Thank you for listening to my comment.
Thank you. It's interesting that the works of Gerald Visner that I have read I would place them more in the realm of the exploring the mythopoetic narratives of his heritage, and then how he translates them into being a person living in today's time. But I have had a great affinity with him because of the place from which he came in the upper Great Lakes region of the Midwest. I didn't really know about his role in or how his work has crossed into legal discourses, and it's a really great observation, because I think that the further we go into trying to talk with each other and trying to understand different speech genres, that's something Bakhtin would talk about. Used either by lawyers or scholars in one or another discipline, there's a lot of mutuality there, for sure.
Can I just add one more thing? Another thing your question made me think of was, I've just been reading a book, and someone here may know the title, I'm forgetting it. It's a collection of deaf Indian writing. And the editors of that book begin by talking about how in most American Indian languages there is no word for disability whatsoever, and it seems, you know, literally to correlate with the no concept of ownership of land, and they are very interesting on what it means to come from, if you're strongly embedded in a culture that has no word for disability, to then be engaging with disability systems.
Gerald Visner was, I know, because he introduced me to his friend, Gary Strankman, who is now a retired judge, I believe an appellate judge in San Francisco. So he actually really has been doing quite a bit of work in that. Actually being involved in law and working with judges, and he was also very involved in the Upper Great Lakes areas and actually proactive legal action, working with Mondale and stuff like that. So it's got a long history of legal involvement. I won't take up any more time.
I've been asked to move us ahead. I know that. Well, why don't we just? We're just going to have one more. I know there was another question here. We'll have one more question and very brief responses, because we have to move to the next part of the schedule.
Thank you. My question is for Tom Kauser. Thank you for that great paper. And Tom, in a sense, it's a two-part question. You called at the end of your talk for imagining new narratives and new kinds of narratives that might get away in disability memoir from what you called sort of older scripts such as triumph, horror, etc. And I'd be interested if you'd speculate on those kinds of scripts, perhaps along the lines of the collaborative narratives collected by Mary Mason. But here's the second part, and this may have more legal implications. We seem to be entering a new moment in memoir. It seems to be announced by charges of hoax and suspicion of memoir, and I wonder if you would speculate on whether that works against a call for new scripts, above all in legal jurisdictions, and precisely for renovating, if anything, in more severe form, those older narratives such as triumph horror and specific harm.
Well, that's a lot to ask. I guess in answer to the first part, I think I used the phrase narratives that claim disability, and I think it didn't really occur to me until I accepted the assignment to come to this conference that for all the disability narratives I've read, very, very few mention the ADA, and I think that's a huge lacuna that needs to be filled. I haven't actually read Simi Linton's. I've heard her read parts of it, but I haven't yet got my own copy, but I think she's going to do something rather different. I think one subgenre in which you do have narrators talking about disability rights legislation is in the subgenre of parental narratives of disabled children. And then you have parents acting as advocates, and I think they're very much aware of the law as an obstacle to their children's access and so on. And Michael Berabe's book about his son who has Down syndrome is a very good example of that, but it's not the first, and I'm sure it won't be the last. I see your point, I think, about the second part, maybe there's a new suspicion of memoir, and this could be, in a way, counterproductive. I think that's what you're suggesting, that and it resonates ironically with the legal requirement that people to have to prove, you know, the first step in a court case, as I understand it, is that you have to prove that you're a member of the protected class to even qualify to make a claim of discrimination. And by analogy, I guess, people have to do that in memoir, and there might be a new suspicion of it, which could be problematic for narrators. But I think we should move on.
Thank you to the panelists. Wonderful.
Mark, I want to ask, this is the time of the day when we go from food for thought to thoughts of food. if you register for the conference, then we do have a lunch for you outside.
You've written about recruiting
subjects. My suggestion is that even though we're running a...
You were recruiting.
Yes.
If you publish that, I'd be interested. You could send it to me by email.
Why don't we take 15 or 20 minutes and be sure that you got your food and come back to your seat by 20 to 1, and then we will... You can eat and listen at the same time. And we will continue with Tony Coelho and the keynote remarks. Thank you.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Wonderful.
The lunches are right outside the door.
No, really, guys.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So
okay.
Well.
Okay. And I'm interested in this
all
new project
you
mentioned.
All of you didn't know what you were doing.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
That's what I was. I really told a friend of
where do you mention? Oh, this new one. I'd be. So, what state is this?